Good Friday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today. We've got a good show for you. Coming up on the program just a little bit, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air will be with us. Kimberly Corbin, rape survivor, self-defense advocate, joining us next hour talking about that new anti-gun video from Cosmo. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart also next hour. Tony Katz coming up in hour three. And we're going to talk about the murder of a Virginia State trooper with John Cardillo, former New York police officer. Also going to talk with John about the increase in violent crime in Chicago. And given that the killer of this Virginia State trooper was from the Chicago area, the two stories are perhaps interconnected. We'll also talk later this hour with Mickey White, Jim Garrity's co-host on the Jim and Mickey show, who is a resident there in the Richmond area. And we're going to talk about what's going on locally there in Richmond with the murder of Trooper Chad Dermeyer. There is a vigil this evening in Richmond. It was originally scheduled to be held at the Diamond, which is the minor league baseball park, kind of very nearby the Greyhound bus station where this attack on Officer Dermeyer occurred yesterday. It has been moved to the campus at VCU in the basketball arena, I think because of the attention and the number of individuals who are expected to attend. We told you this breaking news yesterday afternoon as we were on the air. We didn't have a lot of information. The information that we had was fairly conflicting, but now we do know that Trooper Chad Dermeyer was shot and killed yesterday by a man with a lengthy criminal history. 34-year-old James Brown III had a long and violent criminal history, according to press accounts. Most recently, in 2012, he was sentenced to 2.5 years behind bars after he was convicted of domestic battery and aggravated battery of a pregnant woman. In Kane County, Illinois, he served prison time between 2003 and 2011 after being convicted of aggravated discharge of a firearm, distribution of heroin, possession of weapon and body armor by a felon, and multiple cases of battery. Now, apparently, the list of charges that were never pursued against this individual are quite extensive as well. Arrests made, evidence presented to the prosecutor's office, but for whatever reason, the prosecutor never moved forward on these cases. James Brown III would have been one of our deals of the day, except that we're going to be talking about him and his crime and the man that he killed during a couple of segments of the program today. The governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, on Washington, D.C. radio, D.C. 101, Elliott in the morning, talking about the death of Trooper Dermeyer and the need for more gun laws, common sense restrictions, he said. Said that this guy should not have been able to get a gun. Or should not have been allowed to have a gun, I think is what the phrase was. And he wasn't. That's the thing. He wasn't allowed. But just like there appear to be no shortage of bad people who are ignoring the laws that we have against, you know, in Virginia, for example, the transportation of heroin or the illegal distribution of opioid products. We have in this country as well individuals who don't care that they have lost their right to legally own a firearm. They are living and operating outside of the boundaries of the law. And Governor McAuliffe's answer seems to be, well, we just see these common sense restrictions on people who are living within the confines of the law. We need to make that law a little more confining for those folks, and somehow it'll trickle down to the people like James Brown III. They've been trying that again in Chicago for a long, long time. Let's make it impossible for a law-abiding citizen to own a handgun in Chicago. I mean, they took it to their logical extreme, and it didn't work. I was on Twitter earlier today, and I saw a tweet by a former Baltimore command staff member. He was the former Operations Division Deputy Commander. I think it might have been one of those political moves that led to him being the former Deputy Commander of Ops there in Baltimore. But he had tweeted out something to the new police commissioner in Chicago, saying you have to focus on the most violent offenders. You have to start there. And he had this series of tweets. I don't have them in front of me right now, but he talked about in Baltimore, when they tried to do this, what we've talked about on the program before, you identify the worst of the worst offenders. In Chicago, for instance, 6% of the population right now is most at risk for committing violent crimes and for being victims of violent crimes. James Brown III was from the nearby city of Aurora, Illinois. But if he had lived within the Chicago city limits, he would have been part of that 6%. But even within that 6%, not everybody in that 6% are hardcore gang members. They're not hardcore. They may not commit an act of violence at all. They may be related to somebody who is in a gang. They may be dating someone who has a propensity for violence. The real hardcore offenders, the real perpetrators of that disproportionate amount of violent crime, it's a lot smaller than 6% of the population. It's less than 1% of the population. This guy said in Baltimore, when they first started this, he had their list was 12 names. These are the 12 individuals that we're going to target. And we know that we can do this. This is a reasonable, manageable number. We can keep our eyes on. We can focus our efforts on these 12 guys that we think are the worst of the worst here in the city. He said in Chicago, I think right now the list was almost 300 names. And his point wasn't that, well, Chicago is so much worse than Baltimore. His point was, you know, you've taken this tactic that can be successful. But now you've sort of watered it down. You want to show that you're making a full-scale effort, and you're probably biting off more than you can chew because you really don't have the resources and manpower to engage intensively with those 300 individuals. And you may not even need to, but you've got to prioritize if you want to stop the rise in violent crime, which is the first thing you got to do, and then start to turn it around. But it was interesting. I don't know. Maybe I just missed the tweets, but I did not see this former deputy commander of operations there in Baltimore, Maryland, saying, and, you know, you guys should really pass more gun control laws, too. Because it's the next round that's really going to make a difference here. James Brown III was well known to law enforcement. It was against state and federal law for this man to possess a round of ammunition, much less a firearm. Between 2003 and 2011, he was convicted of aggravated discharge of a firearm, distribution of heroin, possession of weapon and body armor by a felon, and multiple cases of battery. And in how many of those cases were those charges reduced? In how many of these cases where he was serving prison time for these charges, how many of these instances were from plea bargains? How many times was James Brown III told, the next time you are here in court, you have run out of chances. This is it for you. How many times did he hear a variation of that? How many times did he face a 10-year sentence that turned into 5 or a 20-year sentence that turned into 4? We've seen that too, right? How many times did that happen for this man? Who, according to his aunt, said he vowed never to go back to prison. He didn't like it there. Well, how many times did he get out before he should have? How many times did he have to turn his life around, actually say, you know what, I don't like going back to prison. I'm not going to. And then commit another violent crime. Get that deal. Don't do as much time as you should. And then you get back out. A little bit angrier. A little bit more violent. Just as unsupervised. You know, again, we don't have millions of these individuals in this country. We're not even talking about 1% of the population. The most violent offenders, whether it's in Chicago or Richmond or LA or Baltimore. We are talking about a relative handful of individuals who are known to law enforcement, be it the cops on the street, to the prosecutors. Judges can probably recognize some of these guys by name. And yet, again, you listen to politicians like Terry McAuliffe or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, and you don't hear the individual criminal mentioned at all. You don't hear about the need to focus. Well, you don't hear what prosecutors will tell you. You don't hear what law enforcement officers will tell you. You don't hear, we need to focus on these individuals who we see time and time again show up, end up in a jail cell, end up in a courtroom, and end up back out on the streets. You don't hear them say that at all. You hear them say, well, what we need are these common sense restrictions. Seems to me like it's common sense to think that, you know, you shouldn't be able to be, 34 years old, rack up a list of convictions that takes up multiple pages, each and every one of them the result of a plea bargain, each and every one of them with time off for good behavior. Seems to me like that's common sense, too. Matter of fact, that's real common sense. I don't see it as common sense to pass and push for another piece of legislation aimed at law-abiding gun owners when the cops and the prosecutors and the people who are living in the most violent-prone communities will tell you that the people who are committing these violent crimes are the people who are making life miserable for the residents of these neighborhoods aren't law-abiding legal gun owners. I do not see the common sense in that. But we'll talk about this again with John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, Mickey White of the Jim and Mickey Show, again on the reaction there locally in the city of Richmond. We'll also take a look at some of the other top Second Amendment news and information from around the country and around the globe. The Economist, with a piece today on the 50 most violent cities reconsidered. They've taken a look, crunched some of the numbers here. And no, the United States is not home to the most violent city on earth. As a matter of fact, according to The Economist, the United States has just two of the top 50 most violent cities in the world. And there are a lot of countries, by the way, with more cities on the list with very restrictive gun control laws. We'll talk about that coming up this afternoon. Also, we'll let you know what's going on legislatively from coast to coast. We've got news in California. We've got news in Maine. And a lot of states in between. But right now, we're going to take a quick time out. Oh, by the way, I should say this. This is my standard April Fool's Day disclaimer. We don't celebrate April Fool's Day on this program, just so you know. Because I just don't think it's appropriate. B, I've seen, and the reason why I don't think it's appropriate is because I've seen way too many people in radio over the years think that because it's April Fool's Day, that means that they can just throw all of their own credibility out the window. And I've seen that not work out well for a lot of people. Have you seen that happen in your radio career, Cameron?
Oh, man. And I'm with you. Regardless of my employment on this show, I hate April Fool's Day. I haven't participated since childhood. And I think that especially, you know, members of the media as we are, we kind of have it's like CNN wouldn't do it. I mean, I could say a wacky morning show do it, or, you know, someone over on Sirius XM comedy, fine. But I just don't think news organizations should be playing practical jokes and doing April Fool's. So I'm completely with you. There'll be nothing from the NRA News control room having to do with April Fool's Day either.
Excellent. I figured we're on the same page there. And you're right. And you would think it would sort of be common sense that if you are a news organization, there are things that you can report on what other people are doing for April Fool's Day, right? But you don't necessarily want to run that, you know, giant hamster terrorizes Cleveland headline. I mean, that just not – if you're the Onion, maybe, but you could hopefully come up with something better than that if you were the Onion, I would think. But anyway – we won't be doing that here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We are going to take a quick time out, however. And no fooling, when we come back, Ed Morrissey from Hot Air will join us on the program. Mickey White later in the hour as well. Stick around. Just getting started here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting. But it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon. Bat Masterson, Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure. The first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And it's almost 1,000 a day, yeah. Oh. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, you know, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club, but we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important
to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain body types.
A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We'll come on the program this hour, Mickey White, co-host, I should say, the Jim and Mickey Show. I don't want to give Jim Garrity any chance to roll his eyes today, so Mickey is co-host of the Jim and Mickey Show. We'll talk about the local reaction to the murder of Virginia State Trooper Chad Dermeyer yesterday at the Greyhound Station in Richmond after a training exercise, apparently just engaged in conversation with the man, long criminal history from the Chicago area, who then pulled a gun, shot, and killed Trooper Chad Dermeyer. Ed Morrissey of Hot Air is with us on the program right now. Ed, thank you, sir, for coming on the program today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I understand that this is your last appearance for a little bit.
Well, yeah, starting next week, I'm going to be doing a lot of promotion for my book, Going Red, and including doing some guest hosting on another radio network next week, right about the same time that you and I are usually on. And after that, I'm just traveling for the next few weeks. So I'm hoping that we can squeeze some time in at some point, because I love doing the NRA news stuff, and it's just such a fun part of my week. So we're going to try to work on schedules so that we can get a break in here, so I can come back on the show, because I don't want to be gone for too long.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. We love having you on the program as well. But I understand you have a book to promote, and you know there's a limited window of opportunity to really promote that book. So get out there and do it. We will we'll be rooting on your success, and we'll be talking about Going Red as well here on the program as well. So I am curious, because this is one of the I think one of the hard parts about writing a political book these days is that politics changes so quickly, and there is, you know, a certain amount of lead time that comes with writing a book. Our mutual friend Jim Garrity, his first political book was called Voting to Kill, came out right before the 2004 elections, and it was going to be about it was about how the Republicans were building a permanent majority based on national security issues, which did not ultimately happen, right? It's hard to sometimes read those tea leaves. Jim, obviously, you know, is a very astute, I think, political observer here. Has politics in this particular election season, has this, you know, it's such a crazy year in so many different ways. Are you worried that the people that you're talking about, those 2 million Americans across the country, are they the same as they were when you started writing this book yet, or have they changed along with the rest of the country?
No, I don't think they've changed. I don't think that they've changed. And the thing about Going Red is this, is it's really not about candidates. It's not really about political parties as such. It's about the communities that I'm writing about. And those people are still the same people. They still have the same outlook. The book was not written in terms of the primary election. It really was focusing on the general election and how candidates could win them. And of course, I'm writing from the conservative perspective because I want conservatives to win. But you could take the same advice and hand the book to whoever the Democrats nominate and say, this is what you need to do to win in these states, and it would work just as well. And the reason why is because it's about the swing states that Republicans lost in 2008 and 2012 and what it's going to take to win them back. And that's what's in that book will be true no matter who the nominees are. And you're still going to have to do the same type of campaigning. You're still going to have to understand these local communities, how they differ from each other, how they differ from what the national perspective is and how to relate the message of conservatism and the Republican Party in a way that matters to these communities in their local lives. And that's going to be true no matter who the nominee is. So in that sense, no, I'm not worried about that. What I'm worried about is that the eventual nominee won't do this. And it may not have the skills to do this and therefore lose an opportunity to win back the White House.
Talking again with Ed Morrissey, the new book, Going Red. When does this officially get dropped, Ed?
It officially comes out on April 12th. So it's just about 11 days from now because today is April Fool's Day. So, 11 days from now, it officially drops. You can pre-order, of course. You can go to goingredbook.com, and you can find out all the different options for pre-ordering. It's in audio, it's in hardcover, and it's in ebook format. So any number of formats, whatever your preference is, you can find the book in it.
And you get even multiple formats, right? There's no shame whatsoever in buying a hard copy and the audio book. I mean, there's that would work out great. I imagine.
Collect the whole set. That's what I say.
So, you know, well, obviously I know where you stand on the whole capitalism versus communism divide that we saw the president bring up in Argentina last week, right?
Yes. Yeah. I am firmly on the capitalism side of things. I would also say that it does actually matter what your philosophy is.
Oh, I would agree with you.
It really does. It does matter. And it's not just an ideological concern. It colors what you do. Your values color what you do. And I'd also say this. I mean, I heard the president's remarks about this. And this is, I'm sorry, but it is really just sort of a nonsense formulation that he uses on every single thing. If you read his book, The Audacity of Hope, I actually got the audio version of The Audacity of Hope. So he was narrating it himself. And the entire book is this silly syllogism that he sets up on every single topic. You know, whatever the topic is, you know, potato chips. Well, some say potato chips are, you know, you can't eat just one. Some say you should only eat just one. I reject both of those premises and say that you should eat two when you feel like eating two. I mean, it's this, some say this, others say that. Mm-hmm. I say there is no choice to be made. It's all good. He does this with everything. And so when you come to something that really matters, something where you have capitalism on one side, which produced the highest growth of living standards in world history, in human history, and communism, which resulted in tens of millions of people being killed in famines, you can't just say, well, pick two from column A and one from column B. I mean, it doesn't work that way. You can make the argument that there is a certain level of regulation that's needed to make capital markets work properly, and I think that that's true. And the debate should be, well, what is the proper level? What is the, you know, who should have the authority to do that? You know, how far should that go? That's certainly an interesting topic. But on the topic of capitalism versus communism, the whole 20th century answered that topic. And to pretend that that doesn't exist is just sheer nonsense. It's sophistry at its most reductio ad absurdum level.
I'm glad to know that I was not the only one bothered by that, clearly. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's 2016. We've been listening to Barack Obama since, 2007. I kind of thought I was over being shocked hearing words come out of Barack Obama's mouth at this point, Ed. Like, I may have been disappointed. I may have been even disgusted, but shocked, I thought I had gotten past. I was kind of shocked by that, because, as you say, it is such a simplistic statement of, don't really worry about those labels. Just do what works. What part of communism works? I mean, that was my first question. You know, I know he brought up the education system in Cuba. Ed, do you know a lot of Americans who are putting their kids on boats trying to get them to Cuba so they can go to college down there?
No, and I don't know a whole lot of Americans that are trying to get on boats to go to Cuba so they can have the benefits of their fantastic health care system either, as Barack Obama. And that whole thing is such a propaganda ploy. You've had Fausta on the show, right? Fausta Wirtz from Fausta's blog?
It has been a while, but I think we have, yeah.
Yeah, she could give you chapter and verse on the Cuban healthcare system. I mean, they have one that they show off for Western reporters, and then everybody else gets the other one. And the other one is pretty horrendous. And so the education system is great if what you're into is indoctrination into Castroism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's terrific for that. You know, but if you really want an education, then no, you don't go to a communist country that has rigid ideological enforcement of its of communism. Of course you don't do that. You go someplace else where you can have access to other ideas and other concepts. Unfortunately, increasingly these days, that's not the United States either. So you might have to go, oh, I don't know, to Ireland or the UK or something like that. I'm not sure if it's getting any better over there either.
No, I think that you're right. But, you know, what concerns me is that I think that a lot of Americans, I don't know if you read that article in the LA Times yesterday. It was by Erwin Chemerinsky and the dean, I think, of UC Irvine. And they've been teaching a freshman course on free speech. And they were dismayed at how few of the freshman students there really cared, knew a lot, or you know, thought that free speech was even valuable. Most of them are perfectly fine with limiting opinions that that they don't like or find scary or harmful or whatever. And they pointed out, the authors of this piece, that, you know, we've kind of gone now two generations. I mean, the college freshmen have never really grown up in a world in which the Soviet Union or even communism, totalitarianism, was a big concern. They've never really grown up in a world in which there were fights over free speech. And so they are placing a greater value. They said it was, you know, somewhat logical to think that they would place a greater value on hurt feelings than on oppressed speech, because they've seen more hurt feelings than oppressed speech. And it really strikes me that this is one of the reasons, Ed, why we need to know our history, because the ideas of totalitarianism, the ideas of authoritarianism, they don't go away. They adapt. They change. China's not the same as it was under Mao. But, you know, the idea that communism has somehow been hollowed out in China because people are allowed to buy stuff that makes them happy while the government still controls what they access on their smartphones, you know, I wouldn't be willing to make that trade.
No, I mean, I don't know if you saw the story today, but China was cracking down on April Fool's Day jokes. You know, I'm not even sure if that's real. Because today, you can...
Who knows today, right?
You really can't trust. I mean, it sounds true, so it's got to be a gag. You know, if it sounds right. Like a gag, then it must be true. If it sounds true, it has to be a gag on April Fool's Day. But, I mean, the Chinese government cracks down on speech. They crack down on dissent. And they do so pretty brutally, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that the difference is, you know, you and I grew up in the Cold War era, and we knew a lot. It's ironic because there were a lot fewer media outlets, and yet we knew much more about how the world worked 30 years ago. You know, these days, you've got all these different media outlets, and nobody's talking about the fact, or very few people are talking about the fact, that China brutally cracks down on dissent and speech within its territory, that Iran does the same thing. You don't hear about that. You don't hear about it in Cuba anymore either, because it doesn't suit the narrative. And the narrative now is we're all past the isms, and like Obama said, well, you just got to do what works. Well, let me tell you something. It really works for the Chinese government to crack down on free speech. It does, because that way they can make sure that they hang on to power. And if that's what Barack Obama – if that's the value system that Barack Obama has, then maybe he should rethink his whole approach to public life.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. You know, do what works. Well, works for who?
Right.
For, you know, for whom, I guess. Because you're right. Something that works very well for a party that wants to remain the only party that's allowed to operate is not, I don't think, going to be something that works for the people who have to live under that regime, who may want to be able to express dissent, who may be able to want to criticize their leader without having to worry about being spirited away in the dark of night.
Well, and don't forget, too, Cam, that this is not a new concept. I mean, I think it was like 6 years ago. I'd have to go back and check the records on this. But Thomas Friedman wrote this absolutely appalling column about how he wished that the U.S. was a little bit more like China so that, you know, so that the government could just get things done without discussing it with other people. And it was in the context of course, climate change. And, I mean, it's an appalling thing. So So, yeah, I mean, the question is, yeah, sure, it works, but it works for whom and on what basis? Democracy and, you know, representative government is messy, but it's supposed to be messy. You're not supposed to be able to do, you know, huge, broad things unless there is a very large consensus to do them. And so this nonsense is a human failing that if only we just had some, you know, just a couple of people who were smarter and wiser than everybody else and who also just coincidentally happened to agree with me, were given all the power to fix the world, and, well, then everything would be great. And basically that's communism. And we saw, again, we saw it's not just communism, too. It's also fascism. It's all of these totalitarian concepts. And we saw how well that worked out in the 20th century. It killed maybe as many as 100 million people in the 20th century. And it's going to do a lot more than that if we don't remember the lessons of history.
Talking again with Mr. Ed Morrissey. The new book is Going Red. Have you thought about a viral marketing campaign, Ed? Perhaps getting hot air readers on college campuses to chalk by going red.
I had not thought of that, but you know, I could have them chalk goingredbook.com and see how many people feel microaggressed and have to retreat to their safe spaces. I think that would be a marvelous idea, Cam. That's a great idea. We should do that.
Run with it. I'll do what I can to help you. Ed, thank you so much. Best of luck to you, sir, with the book. I hope we do get a chance to talk again soon. But in the meantime, have a great experience on the book tour. I hope I get a chance to listen to you filling in on the radio, and always appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Cam. It's great being on, and we're definitely going to work on that to make sure that I get a chance to duck in on regular occasions here during the tour, too.
All right, man. You be good. Have fun. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, sir.
Ed Morrissey joins us from Hot Air. GoingRedBook.com is the website. Wouldn't that be glorious, Cameron? I don't know why. I wish they had started the chalk thing when Heavy Lifting was coming out. That would have been.
Maybe for the second
thanks,
printing.
Thanks, college students. Yeah, maybe for the second printing. Yeah. All right, Mickey White from the Jim and Mickey Show will be with us after a quick timeout. We had a good time with Ed, but we're going to get a little serious with Mickey here, talking about the murder yesterday in Richmond, Virginia. Virginia State Trooper Chad Durmeyer leaving behind a family, two young kids, and a community is mourning today. But they are remembering Trooper Durmeyer. There is a vigil in Richmond that I think that thousands of people are going to be there for this vigil in Virginia's capital city. We'll talk about how the community is reacting to the death of Trooper Chad Durmeyer with Mickey White, who lives there in the Richmond area, right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Earlier today, there was a presentation from America's First Freedom, and give me a little backstory, JR. You knew that you were going to be there, right? But you didn't know what exactly this event was going to be, did you?
Yeah, basically, I was just told there was going to be some presentation, something that obviously involved a gun, and you know, that was basically the only info I had. Which, you know, after covering quite a few things for the NRA, I've had to go do stories where I had even less to go on. So, you know, I didn't think anything unusual of it. And sometimes you're just told, yeah, there's a story that involves guns. It's in Quantico. Go, you know. So, you know, hey, it's not a big thing. I had a little more guidance here. So I just figured, yeah, there's going to be a presentation. Somebody's getting a gun. And that's about all the info I had.
And so you show up. And what happened, JR?
So I show up, and there's all the builders and these wonderful people who have come together to that have built this custom rifle. And next thing I know, there's Chris Cox, and he starts talking about me, and I'm like, okay, what is going on here? This is not about me. This is not why I do this. It's not why I served. But so basically what happened is all these guys came together, and they created this custom, this amazing rifle. for me, left-handed, you know, 308. You know, there's too much stuff on it for me to even sit here and list, but it's just this amazing rifle that they put together, and they had done it in secret behind my back, didn't tell me, and Chris Cox presented it to me, and I'm blown away. I'm still blown away. I'm looking at this rifle here in front of me, and I'm going, is that really mine? You know, because that's one of those things any warrior, especially gun guy like me, wants something like this,
right?
You know, you just realize it's probably not attainable, but these guys made it happen, and I'm forever grateful for that.
Well, listen, I think that we had a chance to talk with Mark Chestnut yesterday, and he kind of let me know what was going on, and I think everybody there at America's First Freedom was just so happy and honored that they could do something like this, because, you know, JR, and I think that you understand this as well, this is about more than just you. This is, you know, I think a small way of showing our appreciation and, you know, the folks from America's First Freedom's appreciation for everything that you've done for this country and everything that our military continues to do and the men and women of our military continue to do.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I've tried to do, people like to sit and list off my accomplishments, and, you know, that's all fine and dandy, but I think sometimes it gets lost in why you try to keep doing that and why I've continued fighting and tried to conquer the world. And, you know, I think you try to keep up that American fighting spirit that, you know, you might be knocked down, but you're not out, and you got to keep fighting. And, you know, and I try to exemplify that, and because there are wounded warriors out there and a lot of veterans who, you know, need that help up and they need that inspiration. So, you know, it's not really so much about me as it is trying to inspire people and help a fellow wounded warrior up and give them a hand up that they need so they can get back on that horse and get back to trying to conquer the world the way, you know, and conquer your battles one battle at a time, just like we were meant to be.
How concerned are you right now about the state of affairs, both for the job that the men and women of our military are tasked to do, and the shape that our military is in right now?
I think there is way too much social engineering going on and way too many pet progressive causes, and I don't know, focus on just letting our brave men and women to let them do their jobs. You know, I would say when fighting global warming is apparently supposed to be more important than killing ISIS, I would say we have a severe a lack of, you know, the best priorities out there. So there are a lot of changes that have been happening to the military. I don't agree with most of them, especially when they're made by people who have never served. They've never worn boots. They've never walked a mile in my boots or carried my pack. You know, and you really can't have people like that. You know, sometimes you just need to let the military do what it does best, and that is, of course, tackling our enemies, and our enemies are all over the place. ISIS is not contained. It's all over the place. It's in Europe. It's right here in America. And the reality is, let our military do what it does. Stop micromanaging. Stop getting it sidetracked with these ridiculous pet progressive causes. And, you know, and the same thing goes with diplomacy with Iran. I'm one of the 871 American troops who were wounded by an Iranian shape charge. There were somewhere in the neighborhood of 230 or 240 troops who were killed by Iranian shape charges. And now apparently Iran's going to be our buddies after they captured 12 of our sailors and humiliated them around the world.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Next hour, Kimberly Corbin is going to join us, talking more about that Cosmo video. Watch four boyfriends listen to their girlfriends tell them how they really feel about their guns or something like that. Kimberly, again, not a part of that video, not asked to speak to Cosmo, not a part of the Marie Claire anti-gun piece in the March magazine, probably because Kimberly Corbin, as a survivor of a sexual assault and an advocate for self-defense, doesn't fit in with the agenda of the editors there, Marie Claire or Cosmo or the activists at Everytown for Gun Safety. Right now, I want to welcome to the program the co-host of the Jim and Mickey Show, Mickey White, joins us. Mickey, how you doing today?
Good, Cam. Good to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I appreciate you joining us. You know, you're there in the Richmond area. We're talking a lot today about Trooper Chad Dermeyer, Virginia State Trooper, who was murdered there in Richmond at the Greyhound bus station yesterday. The news kind of broke as we were on the air and didn't learn a lot of details, but now we know a lot of details here, and we know that There was a training exercise. The exercise had wrapped up. Trooper Durmeyer apparently was just engaged in a conversation with this man, a guy with a lengthy criminal record, both convictions and even more charges to his name, including murder charges in his past, from the Chicago area, who then pulls a gun in the middle of this conversation and shoots and kills Officer Durmeyer, basically shoots him at point-blank range before he is killed. Now, I know, Mickey, that the, you know, Richmond, look, it's the capital city of Richmond, of Virginia. It's a good-sized city, but it's also, in many ways, I think, a big, small town. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yes, I think that's a very fair way to describe it. In fact, that's how I describe it a lot of times. It is, yes, the capital city, but not even the second largest city, because Virginia Beach and Hampton Roads is. But it's a town that we normally have, you know, for the most part, really good relationships between our cops and our communities. And that's a good thing. We've always kind of, it's odd, we've been able to avoid a lot of the other issues you've seen throughout with kind of the Black Lives Matters movement here because of that, because of it being such a community-type place. And I think whenever things got crazy yesterday, people really started freaking out.
There's a vigil scheduled for tonight at the Siegel Center on the campus of ECU. It got moved from the Diamond where the Richmond Flying Squirrels play baseball, and I'm guessing it's because they're anticipating a pretty big crowd there at this vigil for Trooper Durmeyer. Do you think we're going to see that tonight?
I think that we're going to see a very big crowd out. You know, the community is very supportive of police officers here, and certainly, you know, it ties into the fact that we are a military area as well. So, you know, it all kind of ties into the same respect, I guess, for authority. And in this particular case, there have already been enough issues at that particular Greyhound station to warrant that we know that's a bad area. It also happens to be across the street, as you just mentioned, from the Diamond, where the Richmond Squirrels play. And so, you know, it's a high-crime area, in an area that is kind of in the middle of trying to develop and regrow after, you know, a lot of the other industries left the area.
Yeah, this was actually, I was talking with a friend who lives in Richmond earlier today, and that was his description immediately of the area. He said, well, you know, it's not a good area. It's not a safe place to be in Richmond, which is interesting because it is, as you say, a place that is also trying to gentrify.
Yeah.
They're trying to build in developments. They want those, you know, mixed-use retail spaces. They want the little urban town center developments going in there. But obviously, it's not just a matter of finding the developer who's willing to take a chance. You know, those developers aren't likely to take a chance on a place that is known as a high crime problem area.
Exactly. And again, when there was a recent study done by one of the local TV stations, and it was found that the number one hot spot for calls to the police in Richmond was that Greyhound station.
Really?
Over the last 12 months. Yeah. And I found that to be interesting because a lot of them, you know, they said, you know, some of them were health checks and different things like that, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a station where you've got people coming and going from all over different places. But one of the things that I think people may not realize is, because, of course, I don't know how much national attention it even got, but there was a man arrested from Alexandria here in Richmond at that Greyhound station for collaborating with or attempting to collaborate with ISIS just a few, I guess it would be months ago now. So when the news broke that it was at the Greyhound station, I think that everyone in Richmond took a very deep breath.
Because they were concerned that this was related to terrorism, that this may have been somebody who was trying to carry out some sort of attack.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, isn't that the whole point of terrorism? But, you know, everyone kind of was like, oh, wait, because, again, you know, Richmond being the type of place that it is, we don't normally, you know, we have shootings. We have them all the time, unfortunately. However, they don't normally break into regular programming to cover them. And so I think that was the initial reaction. I think now it's mostly, you know, again, that vigil focused at the Siegel Center tonight. They did move it. My thoughts, maybe because of the weather, as well as the size of the event. I think that you're going to see a lot of the community out in support of Trooper and also his family. And quite frankly, the entire, you know, the entire kind of family out there, the fraternal brotherhood, if you will. Because one of the things that immediately happened, of course, because these were state police troopers on a training exercise, we also ended up having, you know, ATF show up, FBI show up, Homeland Security was here. But understand that you're still got these guys who are the state police deal with Richmond City, Richmond County, Henrico, Chesterfield as well. So they all, you know, kind of work together on a lot of those cases. So I suspect you're going to see a lot of people out tonight at that vigil. I think that, you know, the murderer is dead. So justice has been served as far as I'm concerned on that front. However, you know, that doesn't do anything for the trooper who passed away, nor does it do anything for the civilians that were injured. And unfortunately, you know, we're a strong town. Richmond has been through a whole lot worse than this. And we will pick up our mint juleps and go on.
Talking again with Mickey White. I'm curious, Mickey. We're going to share some audio from Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe later in the program. He was on Elliot in the Morning in the D.C. area today.
Mm-hmm.
And he said his takeaway was that this shows that we have to do something about guns here.
Well, that's really interesting to me, only because, as you mentioned, this man should have never had a gun legally in the first place. He was in prison in Ohio for murder charges. I'm not sure exactly how you keep someone who, you know, should not have a gun, again, what we call criminal scam, you're familiar with them,
mm-hmm.
From breaking the law. And, you know, there was a lot of Bloomberg money spent here. Last year, I suspect we're going to see a lot of Bloomberg money here come November. And, you know, Terry McAuliffe is, he is very anti-gun. And he, you know, he followed along the same suit as everyone else in blaming the gun instead of looking at the person who actually drew the weapon.
There you go. Mickey, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It's always good talking with you. And, I hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
I look forward to it, Cam. Thanks so much for having me on.
You bet. Thank you, Mickey. Mickey White with us, the co-host of the Jim and Mickey Show, resident of the Richmond, Virginia area, talking again about the local reaction to the murder of Trooper Chad Dermeyer. We're going to talk more about the murder of Chad Dermeyer in Hour 3. John Cardillo is going to join us on the program, but I want you to hear a little bit more about Chad Dermeyer himself. The Times-Dispatch with a story. They talked with the chief of Newport News Police, Richard Myers. Chad Dermeyer had served as a officer there in Newport News, left in 2007 to return to his home state of Michigan, where he worked as a police officer before he returned to Virginia as a state trooper. Richard Myers says, a former Marine, Chad's legacy of service goes beyond his impressive resume as a public servant. By all accounts, Chad epitomized what we strive for at the Newport News Police, a tireless pursuit in reducing crime while compassionately and humanely engaging the community as partners in improving our quality of life. He said, at a time when police are incessantly scrutinized for their every action, Chad's death is a painful reminder of the fragility of life that faces every woman and man who has the courage and conviction to wear the uniform and serve their community. The chief says that Chad Dermeyer worked hard not only to fight crime, but to improve communities. We'll be sharing more words of praise and remembrance for Trooper Chad Dermeyer throughout the program this afternoon. And again, talking more about the criminal history of the man who murdered Chad Dermeyer. Guy described by WTVR in Richmond, Virginia, as a man with a long record and a lot of anger at police. long record. I mean, it almost doesn't even begin to describe it. James Brown III, 34 years of age. His aunt, Edith Brown, helped raise James Brown III and allowed him to stay with her until December. She says she told him then he had to leave. She said he always liked the criminal side. And yet he never wanted to go back to prison, according to what he told his wife. Or his aunt, excuse me. He had a lot of anger about the police in the past, she said. He pretty much thought he wanted to be infamous in terms of having a showdown. He always praised those people who got into shootouts with police. Court records show James Brown III had been charged with murder, intent to kill, aggravated battery with a firearm, failure to obey police, resisting a corrections officer, aggravated battery of a pregnant woman, aggravated battery of an unborn child, felony possession of a weapon, intimidation, domestic battery. 34 years old, out on the streets. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzler's, coming up after a quick timeout. We've got more of the day's top Second Amendment news for you right after this.
I'm here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum. Ashley, good to see you again, and thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah, we don't have any guns today.
I know, that's okay. We're going to talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man, the Cody Firearms Museum is actually, it's one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library, and there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms, and they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how there's such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from 1425. Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me, because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company. And so they collected international firearms. They collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, at 1425. And so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West. And so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to tell, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contest or anything?
It's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You want to loan it over here? Loan that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But, you know, what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some... I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had... Right now, they're displaying one of Eisenhower guns and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we. We did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have, so stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum, and it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster, and, you know, first off, I mean, you know, the 61's great, and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it, and then it also... We knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to, like, a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861, and his name is Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in the American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened... across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one, a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it, and then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it, just doesn't get much better.
Awesome. How can we get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA
Thank
News.
You for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Kimberly Corbin, rape survivor, self-defense advocate, joins us later in the hour, talking about the new video from Cosmo, their continued attempts to try to tell young women, you don't want to own a gun. You don't want to date anybody who owns a gun. Bad idea. Kimberly has a different idea, I think, but we'll talk with her about it later on in the hour. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart News will join us later in the hour as well. We have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, coming up next hour. Also, the Deal of the Day and the Good Guy of the Day coming up at the top of hour three. We've been talking about Virginia State Trooper Chad Durmeyer. Talked about the chief of Newport News, Virginia, where Chad Durmeyer served as a police officer. But, you know, and I thought about actually using our Good Guys segment today to talk about Trooper Chad Durmeyer, but I don't think we need to do that. I think we can just take a couple of minutes here. In fact, maybe we should take a couple of minutes here to talk about the good guy that was Chad Durmeyer. He, as I mentioned, served in Newport News till 2007, returned to Virginia, graduated from the Virginia State Police Academy in November of 2014. The Daily Press newspaper says that Brian Bowyer, who's a resident of Newport News, had a brief interaction with Chad Durmeyer, but it stuck with him. Bowyer's daughter was involved in an accident on the interstate in August of 2015. Bowyer's, a former Newport News police officer, talked about the fact that Durmeyer was the investigating officer, and he talked about how Chad Durmeyer had a calming effect on those involved in the wreck. Bowyer said he had everything under control. It was obvious that his calling was to be a police officer. Said he was definitely a person that was happy, confident, and professional. Somebody that you'd be proud to have as a friend and as a coworker. Another news story from the Richmond area, Channel 13, WVEC. They had aired a story back in January of this year that featured Officer Chad Durmeyer. The story was talking about in Hampton Roads on a Friday morning, a guy driving to work, a guy named Dave Floyd, saw these two state troopers who were running down the road going after a little dog. Dave Floyd said they were like talking to the microphone back and forth trying to catch the little dog. The troopers involved in the pooch pursuit, Channel 13 says, Chad Durmeyer and Jeremy Hagwood. First spotted the dog on Interstate 64 in Hampton at LaSalle Avenue. Tailed the little dog by car and then on foot to I-664 at Aberdeen Road. Chad Durmeyer said at the time he was a little guy and he was off to the races. 4 miles they chased the little dog. Trooper Hagwood said he didn't want to stop for us. He kept going around in circles, going the wrong direction on the interstate, running between cars. Some drivers stopped to help. Troopers eventually cornered the dog, scooped him up alongside the road. They were able to ID the dog. Thanks to tags, they returned him to his owner, Jeffrey Corbin, who said, quote, I want to say thank you. Thank you very much, so much. Pinta is a member of the family. He's a great companion to us. Story went viral locally there, got thousands of likes on Facebook at the time. Chad Durmeyer told Channel 13, makes me feel good. This is the type of stuff that makes up our good guy stories every day. And it sounds like that's who Chad Dermeyer was. One of the many, many good guys out there. Killed in the line of duty by a guy who, according to his own family, kind of took pride in being a bad guy. Wanted to be infamous. I don't think he's going to get that infamy. I mean, maybe locally. I don't think anybody's going to regard this guy with a lot of warmth and good feelings in their heart. But I think in the Richmond area, the name of Chad Dermeyer is going to be remembered. And the man who was Chad Dermeyer is going to be remembered a lot more than the man who took his life. But again, we'll talk about this more with John Cardillo coming up in Hour 3. In California, there are some anti-gun bills that are on the move in the state Senate. Senate Bill 894 is a lost or stolen measure. This is not the first go-round for lost or stolen in the California Capitol. Governor Brown has actually vetoed similar legislation twice before, but they're at it again. This would require the victim of a crime in California to report to local law enforcement the theft of a firearm within 5 days, and you have to report to local law enforcement the recovery of the firearm, if you somehow manage to recover it, within 48 hours. Otherwise, you become a criminal. Now, again, keep in mind what's practically, or what's actually taking place, I should say, on the streets of many California cities. If you're the victim of a burglary, and you call 911 and you say, I've been the victim of a burglary, they'll tell you, okay, well, you need to go to the police department. We can't send anybody out. That's not a crime. We don't send the crime scene investigators out there to dust for fingerprints. We're not going to be combing through your stuff and sending out all points bulletin. It's not going to happen. Come down to the police department, fill out a form. Tell us everything that you know that you think has been stolen from you, and we'll keep an eye out. That's what happens right now if you're the victim of a burglary, because they don't have the manpower in a lot of departments in California to do anything other than this. Now they want to try making the victim of a burglary become a criminal. If they fail to provide that full and complete accounting to police within, 5 days of knowing that that gun is gone. How is this supposed to help? The idea, according to the anti-gun activists, is that this is going to cut down on straw purchasers. People who are buying a gun for somebody who's not legally allowed to own that firearm. Often they say when the gun is recovered, traced back to the original owner, the original owner says, oh, you know what? That gun was stolen. Yeah, I should have reported it. Sorry, I just didn't. Or, you know, weirdest thing, I lost that gun. I just lost it, and I didn't tell anybody. So the idea supposedly is that if a law like this is on the books, that either those individuals who are saying this won't say that. They'll I don't know what they'll do. Call the police, and after that gun has been given up in an illegal transaction, say, hey, my gun just got stolen. In which case, again, the police will say, okay, thanks, and file that information away, but they're not going to start a huge investigation trying to track down that gun. In that case, has the person indemnified themselves by reporting that gun stolen? Maybe. The other, I guess, argument is that, well, if these straw purchasers do engage in this illegal activity. And then they don't call police and say, well, my gun got lost or my gun got stolen. Then if we find out that they were engaged in a straw purchase, then we can charge them with failure to report this firearm lost or stolen. But you could also charge them with being a straw purchaser. And the punishment is going to be far greater for being a straw purchaser than it's going to be for failing to report a firearm lost or stolen. So, again, what is the point of this legislation? Other than for lawmakers to say, we're doing something that's aimed at law-abiding gun owners. I don't get it. And I got to tell you, a lot of prosecutors don't understand the concept of what they're trying to do here other than make life tougher for law-abiding gun owners. They tried this in Pennsylvania a few years ago, and prosecutors said, we don't want this. This isn't going to help us. You want to cut down on straw purchasing? Here's an idea. Let's up the penalties. Let's up the punishment for engaging in a straw purchase. And that's exactly what they did, but the anti-gun activists didn't like that. So despite the fact that the Pennsylvania legislature got tougher on straw purchasers, the anti-gun activists still took their lost and stolen legislation on the road. They got several dozen communities in Pennsylvania to pass these enforceable ordinances, unenforceable ordinances. I've watched this bill appear in various forms around the country for a number of years now, and I've yet to hear the argument as to how this is actually supposed to impact violent criminals. That makes sense. I've heard the arguments that are given. Haven't heard the one that actually works. But that is Senate Bill 894 in California. Senate Joint Resolution 20 would urge the Congress of the United States to lift a prohibition against publicly funded research on the causes of, quote, gun violence and its effect on public health. Of course, there is no prohibition on publicly funded scientific research on the causes of gun violence and its effects on public health. What there is a prohibition on the CDC engaging and spending money on studies that promote gun control, on propaganda, on things like that study that we saw in the quote-unquote study that we saw in Lancet recently that said, you know, if you just pass these three laws, then your violent crime rate could drop by 90%. If you just had, quote-unquote, universal background checks, if you had registration requirements for firearms and for ammunition, and so every time you bought a box of ammo, you'd have to undergo a background check, and that would reduce a violent crime, they said, by 90%. Now, even a lot of anti-gun researchers came out and said, yeah, we don't think that it would reduce it by 90%. That's really overstating things. You're talking about a fairly modest reduction if you saw a reduction. But there's no way you're going to see 90% drop in violent crime. Do you want that? I mean, look, these studies clearly are being done right now. They're clearly finding an audience in even some prestigious medical journals. But they're not being subsidized by your tax dollars. And that's what anti-gun advocates would like to change. Sure, they've got a billionaire with deep pockets, but why use Bloomberg's bucks when you can use the taxpayers' dollars? So that is a Senate Joint Resolution 20. Again, also in the state of California, expected to be heard next week in the Senate Committee on Public Safety. They've got a hearing next Tuesday, April the 5th at 9 a.m. At the state capitol in Sacramento. If you can make it there, you should definitely try to do so as a California gun owner. And you know, it's interesting, we're talking about violent crime and what works to actually reduce violent crime as opposed to the do something proposals that we hear from anti-gun politicians. I mentioned last hour, The Economist has a story out revisiting the world's most violent cities. So they took a look at the latest annual ranking of 2015's most violent cities in the world by this Mexican non-governmental organization, CCSP-JP, which placed Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, at the top of a list of 50 cities with populations of at least 300,000 people with the highest homicide rates in the world. they have revised these numbers, The Economist has, basically because it's so difficult to figure out what the actual homicide rate is in the socialist utopia of Caracas. Official homicide totals haven't been issued since 2009. In fact, crime statistics haven't officially been measured in Venezuela since 2009. That way you avoid all of the messy headlines about crime skyrocketing out of control. You just don't keep track. So they said we really can't determine what the actual number is for Caracas. We know it's bad. But when they started really looking at the numbers here, and they started revising the numbers, they said the biggest differences between the two data sets, these revised numbers for what makes the most violent city in the world the most violent city in the world, Venezuela and El Salvador. They said they just threw the Venezuelan data out because it's considered too unreliable. Instead, El Salvador's capital, San Salvador, tops the city ranking, 188 murders per 100,000 people. Let me say that again. 188 murders per 100,000 people in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Do you know what our homicide rate is here in the United States, just by comparison? And this is, again, this is for the entire country. This is not just for the capital city. I could tell you what the homicide rate is for our U.S. capital as well. In 2014, homicide rate in the United States, 4.5 per 100,000 people. Again, compared to 188 per 100,000 in the capital of El Salvador. Now, specifically, you want to look at Washington, D.C. versus San Salvador. In 2014, in Washington, D.C., the homicide rate was 15.9 per 100,000 people, compared to 188 per 100,000 people in the capital of El Salvador. But they say the country that they're paying the most attention to, Brazil, they say there were 32 Brazilian cities in the top 50 cities with the highest homicide rates. 32 of them, 32 of the top 50 are in Brazil. More than 10% of all the world's homicides are in Brazil, The Economist says. And although the rate has fallen in its largest cities, it has started increasing in smaller ones. And they say the problem is likely to grow as the economy falters and young men are unable to get jobs. So coming up later on in the hour, I want to talk about what the gun laws are like in El Salvador and what the gun laws are like in Brazil. You know, it was just a few years ago that there was a referendum to actually ban gun ownership in Brazil. And the anti-gun activists around the world, including the folks at IANSA, the International Action Network on Small Arms, they thought they had this one in the bag. It was already really, really tough to legally own a gun in Brazil. There weren't many legal gun owners. Homicide had been sky high for a long time. There was no natural constituency of people who owned firearms. Who would vote no in order to maintain possession of those firearms. There was no right to keep and bear arms in the Brazilian Constitution. All they had to do was get a majority of voters to say, you know what, we think that the best way to fight violent crime is by banning guns. And they couldn't. They couldn't. In a nation that had really restrictive gun control laws, in a nation in which most people were never going to be allowed to legally possess a firearm, in a nation with a very high violent crime rate, most of the citizens who voted said, no, we don't think the answer is banning firearms. And here we are a few years later, and actually, you know, in Brazil again, the crime has gotten worse. The gun laws haven't particularly gotten better, but there is a big push in the Brazilian legislature, at least there was until this corruption scandal kind of overtook everything, and now they're talking about impeaching the president. So I don't know where these bills stand, but earlier this year, there were reports that there was legislation that would actually allow for the right to carry for self-defense that was going to be introduced in Brazil and was actually fairly popular, was expected to pass. That's where, again, the mindset of the people in Brazil is trending. They've tried the really restrictive gun control laws. They've tried them for a long time. Now they want to try being able to protect themselves. And on that note, why don't we take a time out? Because when we come back, we're going to talk with another self-defense advocate, Kimberly Corbin. She wants to be able to protect herself. She wants other women to have the choice to protect themselves as well. We're going to talk about the latest video from Cosmo, where we've got some gunsplaining going on by some anti-gun girlfriends. We'll talk about it with Kimberly right after this quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered woman, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
maybe
took 2 years to get the guts to do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
What is your barbecue of choice in Austin?
It is Terry Black's barbecue in Austin.
Nice.
Love that place. Under siege by local authorities because apparently the smell of barbecue smoke is offensive in Austin, Texas. So,
yes,
go check it out.
Hipsters, that doesn't matter.
No, that's just it. It shouldn't irritate hipsters. I mean, that's the whole essence of being in Austin, Texas. But I was just giving Cam tips on good rib barbecue.
Mustard. Put the mustard. I've got a microphone. Thank you.
It puts the mustard on the barbecue or else it gets the hose.
Or else it gets the rub again, I believe is right.
All right, so I'm going to go back to my special across the street, across the lot.
Why are you leaving? Did we run you off there? All right,
no. It's just we have limited microphones and you know, something.
I'm really glad I got invited. It's great.
Why are you still here?
That's really good. That's fantastic.
Tony's used to a little more one-on-one time, a little special time here.
No, what we need is more Andrew Langer. That's the said no one ever, including his wife.
God, it gets worse.
Lord.
Wow.
This is happening.
Oh, there you go.
I heard there was a party over here, and I wanted to just see what was happening. I'm trying to tape a special across the hall here, and it's getting very noisy, and I wish you would all. And who's the one with the British accent that keeps interrupting
everybody?
That's
Tony. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. It's Tony Katz.
I've lost complete and all control.
You've had about 3 minutes to think of a question, and you still haven't managed it.
Here's the thing. Who's the question to right now at this point?
Ask all of us. We'll all answer.
Okay.
What's the question?
Ask the question.
Ask the question.
What is the question?
There's a ratio, people. A ratio.
Here's my question for you. Obviously, you haven't had anything like this chaos on the show, on your show.
On my show?
Yeah, over the last couple of days.
Larry O'Connor, like you did in the old days. This is actually how Larry worked his way through everything.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, coming to you from Farmville, Virginia, where it is warm enough for the snakes to be out and about. Dr. AWR Hawkins of Breitbart will join us on the program. Right now, I want to welcome to the show Kimberly Corbin, a rape survivor, self-defense advocate. Kimberly, it is great to have you back with us on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Cam.
You bet. So, Cosmo Magazine, at it again. This time they've got a little video feature on watch four boyfriends listen to their girlfriends tell them how they really feel about guns or something like that.
Right.
And oddly enough, Kimberly, not one of the women featured there is really okay with the idea of her boyfriend owning a gun.
Well, and really, where are the women like me in that video? All I saw were women who had an unhealthy fear of firearms, basically because the media has told them that they should. Ironically enough, it was actually an article in Cosmo that resonated in my 20-year-old mind during the early morning hours of my assault. So I had read some story about a woman who used the tact of befriending her rapist who had kidnapped her. She convinced him that she wasn't going to tell anyone, and she escaped. I tried the same thing after my assault was complete. He left my bedroom to go get a drink of water from my kitchen and then took off through the front door. I had no way of defending myself that morning, but, you know, I have stared in the eyes of pure evil, and I knew that I wouldn't be left defenseless again. So, of course, I choose to learn about concealed carry and train to a point where I'm comfortable using a firearm for protection. I am literally nowhere represented in that video.
Nope. Not at all. No. I mean, in fact, you got four variations of the same theme.
Right.
As you said, I am afraid of firearms. One guy even said, you know, look, I keep my firearms locked up. And his girlfriend said, so you don't know how to operate a key when you're drunk? Which to me makes me think, you know, okay, is the concern here his drinking or his gun ownership? You know, there was a lot of stuff that you wish you almost wish you could have been a relationship counselor in that situation, right?
Exactly. Well, and I think by design, they cast males as the only gun owners in that video because honestly, they're easier to villainize because statistically speaking, men are usually the perpetrators of domestic violence or sexual assault, at least more often than women. It's not difficult for readers or viewers to make that leap from a distrust of men to an inherent distrust of guns. And that's exactly what, you know, Everytown, Shannon Watts, and newfound besties at Cosmo want you to understand and take away from that.
Yeah, this is, I think what really concerns me is because this isn't an honest debate and it's not an honest conversation.
No.
This is a branding campaign.
And, oh, my gosh, absolutely.
And, you know, what they are trying to brand is guns are not for women.
No, and I think that they're so used to pandering to a specific type of brand. You know, God forbid some of us women who want to take quizzes and see what scandal character we are and that we do morning yoga and we go to brunch with our girlfriends afterwards, God forbid we own firearms somehow and we're now supposedly less than because we've educated ourselves and want to choose to take our self-protection seriously. Why is that so bad?
Well, I don't think it's bad at all. And, you know, it's interesting, Kimberly, because I think it may have been the same day that this video was released by Cosmo. There was the story, I know that you saw this out of Indianapolis, a young mom at home with her infant. Guy breaks in. Mm-hmm. She has a gun. She uses that gun in defense of herself and her child. The guy is found to have on his person zip ties and a walkie-talkie, which kind of tells me this guy was in communication with somebody else and this guy wasn't necessarily interested in the stuff.
Right.
That was inside that home. He was interested in the people who were inside that home.
So often, more often than not anyway, sex assault is about power and control. It's not about sex as so many people want you to believe, especially when it's being touted by a political campaign. You know, I have honestly been told, well, you survived without a gun. What's the big deal? You know,
wow.
You use different methods to get away, and they don't use a gun. And statistically, that could have been turned around on you anyway. The biggest problem here is that those comments start with victim blaming. It's on me somehow to think of ways to get away without turning to, like, literally the greatest equalizer of our time. Statistically, men are bigger than women. What's the best way to physically equalize myself against an attacker? A firearm. I'm not going to take my chances with a rape whistle. Or, you know, I actually tried saying that, hey, I made up a lie, said I have an STD, I have to go to the bathroom, I'm claustrophobic. I tried all of these things. They did not thwart that attack. But, I mean, furthermore, what no one cares to hear is that while I might have been my attacker's first victim that we could at least identify, at the time of his arrest, it was just 3 weeks later, he was picked up at an apartment complex not half a mile from mine. He was taking pictures of other college women that were sunbathing around the pool. He's choosing his next victim. So, yes, I survived. But at what point does this man's growing number of victims and escalating behavior stop? This guy had zip ties in his back pocket and all of these things. But, you know, we're not going to hear more than one or two media cycles because it doesn't fit the mainstream media narrative.
Right.
But he had to start somewhere. And I'm guessing he started at the same point as my rapist did. It's breaking in. It's stealing underwear. It's seeing how far you can get. How far can you push until you just start escalating and escalating? And, yes, this woman did a fantastic job of protecting herself and her kids, and that story is not going to get the attention that it so deserves. But the Cosmo articles definitely will.
That's the thing. I don't even know if this story out of Indianapolis, I don't think it got national attention. I think I saw it in one other like local TV station that wasn't in the Indianapolis area had picked up the story, but you're right. And you know, the Cosmo story is going to get that attention. Here's the thing though. You know, I think, as you say, I don't think Cosmo is serving its audience, because I'm guessing, Kimberly, that there are some Cosmo readers out there who are also gun owners.
Or at least there were.
Or, yeah, okay.
Well, this is going to sound terrible. I was scrolling through their Twitter feed looking for that original post about the gun control conversation.
Yeah.
Let me give you a little brief taste of what these guys also peddle to their readers. Are you ready for this? What it's like to fall in love with your brother. Real headline. Are you sexually attracted to the wax version of Justin Bieber? And why drink normal beer when you can drink vagina beer? Excuse me, that is in no way, shape, or form the people that I want telling me about how best to protect myself. I literally feel my face melting from the stupidity.
Suffering from a lack of credibility is what you're saying.
I think that's exactly what this is.
Yeah. Well, you know, and maybe you're right. Maybe that's the reaction of most people. But it is worth noting that, you know, every town certainly thinks that this is a relationship that is worth, collaborating on, right?
I mean, they're right. Sadly, they are right. They're well in position to reach a viewership or a readership of women who might not otherwise pay attention to politics, who can look at this video and say, oh, yeah, well, obviously. I think one of the women actually refers to him as a death machine. And they're thinking, well, that makes total sense. And I'm only hearing there's four different couples in this video, and I'm hearing the same thing from each one. It has to be accurate. I got to say, as somebody who's just recently waded back into the scary dating world, I can tell you that these forced and prompted conversations that are depicted in that video are absolutely not indicative of what real and, like, thoughtful discussions around ownership should include. I'm not asking if a boyfriend has a gun. I don't care. I care more about what that person is capable of doing with or without a firearm. If your potential partner is exercising their First Amendment right, are you going to say, oh, no, I don't like what you're doing, what you're saying, even though it's completely legal? Here's a little pro tip, ladies. If you don't like what your boyfriend's doing, believe me, you don't have to date them. I know that's weird.
No, I think that's – listen, I think that's fantastic advice. And – you know, we haven't really talked about this much, Kim, but you know, your day job, I mean, you are a victim's advocate. You are dealing with and helping with victims of violent crime. You know, when you hear that this is like, this should be one of the warning signs if your boyfriend owns a gun, as somebody who is an advocate for victims, you think that's silly?
Absolutely, I do. I worked as a victim advocate for the police department. I started 3 years following my assault after I did a ton of counseling and made sure that I was on a level where I could actually help people. I never disclosed that I was the victim of a sex assault when I'm helping these victims.
Mm-hmm.
Gun ownership has nothing to do with the people that I'm sitting with or talking to. I've been with the district attorney's office now almost 5 years, and I can tell you the types of cases that we see come through here are more to do with power and control, not whether or not they own a firearm. That has nothing to do with it. These people don't need firearms to control victims in these DV relationships. It's sad and it's scary, but these kinds of conversations are exactly what keep the focus off of who these people are, regardless of, as Cosmo says, what they have in their drawers. You've got to do some more searching, and I think as friends and family, you have to be vigilant about who these women are dating. I mean, if you see red flags, tell that person, tell that woman that you see these kinds of things from the outside, because so often they're pulled in because these are the types of relationships that are exactly what they're seeking, and that's not always the easiest thing to identify up front, but I can guarantee you it has nothing to do with whether or not that person has a gun. That does not need to be at the top of your checklist when you think you may be getting into a relationship.
So when you're talking about red flag behavior, let's talk about what you should be looking for then.
Sure.
You mentioned power and control.
Yes.
When you see evidence of that, somebody who needs to maintain that power and control, whether it's, you know, they're very possessive when they're out of somebody's site, they're constantly texting, checking in, belittling, wanting to maintain that emotional power and control over someone in the relationship. Is that what you're talking about? Are those some of the warning signs?
It is. But what's hard to see is that it's like all of these domestic violence offenders, and I'm not saying that it's just men because there are female domestic violence offenders as well. It's like they all read from the same playbook. The problem is that at the beginning, it's so subtle and sophisticated that you can't really recognize that that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things move very quickly. Oh, they're sweeping you off the feet. It's called the honeymoon phase, where they will just go out of their way, and they're always there for you and checking up and doing these wonderful things that you just think are straight out of a fairy tale. Well, as time progresses, it's not so great that they're checking in with you 20 times while you're out on a girl's night. And it's, you know, that oh, my gosh, you're all mine. That's wonderful. It turns into what will actually manifest as severe jealousy. Controlling behaviors aren't so black and white at the beginning. It's something that escalates, and once you get further and further in, it's harder to identify and harder to leave those situations. That's where I come back to victim blaming, not just with the sexual assault community, but also with domestic violence. You can't blame those victims. It is very, very difficult not only to identify from the inside, but also to exit. And at the times that you get out of those relationships, that is when they are at the highest conflict and there's the biggest issue with possible retaliation. That's when, as females, you have to control as much as you can, get help, look at the resources that are around your community, and start speaking to people. Domestic violence offenders do a really good job of alienating people from friends, from family, and those are the people that want to help you the most. If I have any words of advice, it's to reach back out to those people, because regardless, they are going to want to help.
Kim, listen, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the program. I always love talking with you, and thanks for everything that you do.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on, and keep up the good fight, Cam.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Kimberly Corbin joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. When we come back after a quick timeout, Dr. AWR Hawkins of Breitbart joins us. We've got the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCore Defense. The Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, coming up at the top of Hour 3 as well. Stick around. We'll be back with much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
With Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NR training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways, totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the draws about my class is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them. And everything is different. And it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on the, on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
But, and I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, has, I got your 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like, guys are like, honey, try this big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pigeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's
here.
Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but... You went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kelly, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Coming up next hour, John Cardillo, former New York police officer. Talking about the violence in Chicago, as well as the murder of Virginia State Trooper Chad Dermeyer, Tony Katz. Host of Tony Katz of the Morning News joins us on the program as well. Right now, I want to welcome from Breitbart News, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins to the program. How you doing, Dr. A.W.?
Oh, doing great, Cam. Great to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. And there's, got to tell you, there's a lot of stuff going on legislatively, kind of quietly around the country. There is so much attention and energy on the presidential election that it's really easy to miss stuff that's going on in state legislatures around the country. But just in the past week, I know you've reported this at Breitbart, we saw Iowa become, what, the 42nd state in the nation to legalize the use of suppressors?
Right, 42nd. And that's a huge deal, and you know it, and I know it. It's good for new shooters, It takes away that sound that makes them flinch. It's good for shooters of all ages because it reduces the decibel level of the shot. I mean, honestly, from all angles, it's a good thing. And of course, it's good because it's not another expansion of freedom. It's another recognition of freedom. And, that's what I like. I like that people are retrieving their freedom piece by piece in these states. I like to see that happening.
I do too. And again, broad bipartisan support for this legislation in Iowa, signed by Governor Terry Branstad, had a signing ceremony for it earlier this week. Meanwhile, we've got campus carry news really all around the country. Right. You've got campus carry advancing in Tennessee. Campus carry is still on Governor Deal's desk in Georgia. And hopefully gun owners are still contacting the governor's office there. Yeah, I'm curious, Dr. Hawkins, we have not really talked about your personal thoughts on this, but I mean, you are a PhD. You've spent a number of years on a college campus. What do you think about the argument that we hear so often from opponents of campus carry that college students are just, they're too irresponsible, they're always drunk, they're way too high strung. You know, if somebody gets a bad grade or if we're having an intense discussion in the class, I'm afraid that a concealed carry holder is going to pull out their gun and shoot somebody. I mean, you've been on plenty of college campuses. What's your take on that argument?
Well, my take on that argument is college campus or not, the person that carries a gun is going to be 21 years or older, except in certain states. West Virginia just became an exception, and I think Idaho may be an exception with a concealed carry permit. But, you know, you have – as a PhD, I am a slave to facts, and facts that you gather via research show that concealed carry permit holders are among the most lawful people in the country, if not the most lawful. And as a – when I was a professor visiting or otherwise, you know, when I was a instructor visiting or otherwise, I know there are times when you would feel better if you were armed. Not so you could be aggressive with people, but just because there are moments when a student is not happy with a grade or things get heated and you understand, I really have no recourse if they come at me here or if one of these students is carrying a gun, I have no recourse. And students share that same trepidation. It's not just something that the instructor or the professor would feel. So I don't buy into any of the arguments. The same arguments were made to keep guns out of churches. The same arguments were made to keep guns out of public parks, on and on. I don't buy any of the arguments. Law-abiding citizens are law-abiding wherever they are. And as we say, we're not talking about going into a frat house and just handing out guns. When you talk about campus carry, you're talking about people who have a concealed carry permit. So they're already in almost every state, 21 years or older. They're non-traditional students and they have the facts on their side and their lives are worth defending. Whether they're in a classroom or Walmart or the gas station, a life is a life and it's worth defending. And I think any argument that goes against self-defense is wrong. And that's my opinion.
Talking again with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart. To that end, let's talk about one more bit of breaking news, Dr. Hawkins. I don't know if you've I'm sure you've seen this already, but legislative document 1572 in the state of Maine. This is the bill that deals with subsidized housing and you know tenants of subsidized housing not being banned from gun ownership. This has now gone to Governor Paul LePage for his signature. This is, it's not just a hypothetical situation. We're talking about the case of Harvey Limbo there in Maine.
Right.
Lobsterman, disabled individual who had purchased a firearm after being the victim of multiple burglaries. The day after he bought that firearm, somebody broke into his apartment while he was there, apparently looking for his medication. Harvey acted in self-defense. No charges were filed, but his apartment manager moved to evict him.
Right.
Because Harvey had that firearm.
Right. But see, here's the deal. I know you're going to say it, but I'm going to say it because it honestly chaps me so bad. I get fighting mad for people like that gentleman. If you are taking public money for a certain class of housing if you are receiving public funds for a certain class of housing, you're just going to have to grin and bear it. You can't deny the right to keep and bear arms any more than you can deny the right to free speech and all the other rights enumerated or otherwise in the Bill of Rights. You have to abide by these things. I hope the governor signs this. I remember covering that gentleman's story. That gentleman was, I'm not putting him down, he was scared to death. He was scared to death because of so many burglaries. So he buys a gun for self-defense. And what's the result? He's being punished? No way. You know, everything's backward. This bill will fix that, and I hope the governor will sign it.
I hope he will, too. Listen, Dr. Hawkins, I appreciate you coming on the program. Sure, it is always a pleasure talking with you, and you're doing a fantastic job and keeping up with all the Second Amendment news over there at Breitbart.
Oh, thank you. I'll see you in Louisville pretty soon.
Yes, sir. Less than 2 months now.
Yep. I look forward to it. You have
Me
a great
too.
Day, my friend.
You too. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joining us from Breitbart here on NRA News Cam and Company. May 19th through the 22nd in Louisville, Kentucky. That is when the NRA annual meeting kicks off, and that is not an April Fool's joke. It really is May 19th through the 22nd. Also not an April Fool's joke. Probably want to get your hotel squared away very soon, or you may find quite a drive for you from the outer suburbs of Louisville into the convention center each and every day. Don't let that stop you, though, by the way. We talked with folks in Nashville, Tennessee. They were staying 50 miles outside of town, and they still had a smile on their face. They were still more than happy to be there. Now, coming up top of the hour, we've got the... Yeah, you know what? Cameron just let me know there's a press conference going on talking about the murder of Virginia State Trooper Chad Dermeyer. Let's jump in and listen to that live a little bit, Cameron. Thanks.
Yesterday that, unfortunately, we've gotten very good at handling these matters. And I don't know that that's a good thing. It makes us efficient, but I'm not sure that we celebrate that. So with that said, I will try to answer your questions. Yes, ma'am. As far as we know, we found no connection to anyone else. There was one individual that approached him there in the bus terminal, but this individual seemed to approach everybody. So we have no indication of anyone traveling with him at this particular time, no evidence. Yes, sir.
In a general picture, can you tell us, here's a violent offender with a weapon. As a police officer, what does that say to you?
What does it say to me? It says we've got a lot of work to do. I'm concerned that he's able to obtain a gun. We know that that gun was bought a little over a year ago. It was not bought by Brown. We don't know to this point how Brown acquired it. We're still working with the ATF to try to determine that. But it's very troubling that he would have a gun. It's very troubling that he's out having the history that he has and able to travel on a bus line. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that specifically. We know that I have heard that there was some discussion that he had had, and maybe Aurora Police had said something about that, but I'm not familiar enough with it to comment on.
Could you go over the sequence? Sorry, who was going for their luggage? Was Brown going for his luggage?
Brown was going for his luggage, and he walked away from it. If there was anything, and I think I described it a little bit last night, if it was anything, it was probably small talk to try and engage him and find out, you know, what he was doing and so on and so forth. But the two of them weren't together more than a few seconds. So any conversation was very slight. Yes, sir. That we couldn't tell from the video. We don't really know. You know, we're looking for people that may have been acting suspiciously, but we don't know really what drew him to Mr. Brown. And, of course, again, we don't know the words of the conversation, but believe that he was having some small talk just for that brief time. Yes.
He faced these significant charges in Illinois. I understood murder was among the things that he had at least been charged with. Do you know whether time in prison and was released?
My understanding is he was convicted of a lesser charge, of a lesser firearms charge as a result of that that murder charge. I don't know the circumstances of it. And he served, I believe, 2 years as a result of that offense. Yes.
We're listening to a press conference here in Richmond, Virginia, about the death of Trooper Chad Dermeyer. Some information that you heard. Was that the chief there in Richmond, Cameron? I didn't get the person who was speaking there at the podium.
No, I can't. There's no name on here, but he's wearing a Virginia State Police uniform, so I would imagine he's the commandant or the superintendent of the Virginia State Police.
Okay.
High-ranking official, of course.
Okay, so again, what we learned just over the last couple of minutes here from this press conference, the gun that the killer of Trooper Dermeyer had in his possession, purchased a little more than a year ago, not purchased by the individual who is not legally eligible to own a firearm. You heard the frustration from the spokesman for the Virginia State Police who was standing there, who said, you know, this guy, it was troubling that he was out. It was troubling that he had a gun. It was troubling that he was out on the streets, given the charges that he had been facing. And then later on, you heard that question right before we ducked out here, talking about the criminal history. You know, he was charged with a murder up in Illinois. Do you know anything about that? And we heard that he was convicted of a lesser firearms charge. So I'm guessing that the conviction was actually a plea to a lesser firearms charge. The murder charge went away. He pled guilty and received a conviction for the firearms charge. And the individual with the Virginia State Police said that James Brown III, he believed, served 2 years for that crime. Now, keep in mind, if he's a felon in possession, that case in federal court means 10 years behind bars, with 85% of your sentence served before you are eligible for early release. That means you serve a minimum of 8.5 years behind bars. Instead, a murder charge gets plea bargained down to 2 years for a firearms offense. We need another law on the books, really? Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities, to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys meaning guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. Little skinny tires, you get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot. Awesome. And it is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets a guy that's in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever, and not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 2007. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program. Cool. Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I knew exactly what you're talking about. There was another organization who worked with wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all of these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. And I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obvious you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. Vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is on the air right now. John Cardillo, former New York police officer, joins us later on in the hour. We're going to talk about the death of Virginia State Trooper Chad Dermeyer at the hands of James Brown III, a man with a lengthy criminal history. A lot of charges, a lot of plea bargains. And once again, you know, this theory that I have here that you can commit all kinds of violent crimes as long as you don't end up on the front page of the newspaper, as long as you don't end up the lead story of the nightly news, chances are you are going to get a deal. Whatever charges it is that you are arrested on, those are probably not the charges that you are actually going to be convicted of. Those are not the charges that you will have to plead guilty to. And the sentence that you receive for those charges is not the sentence that you will actually have to serve. Again, we just learned here, James Brown III, according to the Virginia State Police Superintendent, this murder charge that he was facing in Illinois, plea bargained down, charge dismissed, ends up pleading guilty to a felony firearms charge. At that point, likely felon in possession of a firearm. And again, this is in the Chicago area, where violence is skyrocketing. This was not a case that was referred to. This is a guy, again, with a lengthy criminal history. But this wasn't one of those cases, one of those few cases referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office. This wasn't dealt with at the federal level, where, again, possession of a round of ammunition can get you 10 years in the federal prison system, 8.5 years guaranteed to serve before you're eligible for early release. Looks like this was handled locally. Cook County or Kane County, reach that plea deal, get the paperwork through, shuffle them along. Who's up next? You know, let's get to our deal of the day. I said that this guy easily could have been our deal of the day, and Trooper Dermeyer easily could have been our good guy of the day. But these stories are not unique. This is the problem. So 9 News in Denver, KUSA. An arrest has been made after multiple people were injured in a fire that broke out Sunday night at a Denver apartment complex. Thursday morning, he was identified as Kenneth Leon Shepard, facing felony arson charges. When Denver police and Denver fire investigators tried to arrest him, he jumped out of the second-story bedroom window of the house that he was in. Investigators caught him after a short pursuit. Police say that Shepard has a long criminal history, starting in 1978 in Weld County, where he received a deferred sentence for vehicle theft. In the years after that, Nine News says Shepard was arrested multiple times in many jurisdictions across Colorado, including Denver, Aurora, Lakewood. He's been accused of theft, fraud, aggravated assault, bribery, parole violations. First went to prison in 1986, according to the Colorado Department of Corrections. KUSA says he has been in and out ever since. He has skipped out on parole. Last stint in prison in 2012, released later that year. The fire broke out just before 9 p.m. at the Federal View Apartments. 11 people were taken to the hospital. Two of them were critically injured. Multiple people forced to jump from the second and third stories of the building to escape the blaze. Now, again, this won't be a national news story. Thankfully, nobody died. But here you have another career criminal, another guy who has been known to law enforcement throughout the state of Colorado for decades, who, thanks to the work of firefighters and probably some blind luck, managed not to kill anybody the other day. According to court documents, investigators found surveillance video at the fire building and the building next door. The video shows a person later identified as Shepard going into the building that was later on fire, dressed in what appeared to be a bathrobe and a sheet on his head. Court records then state Shepard was seen leaving the parking garage next door before the fire and walking to the building where the fire later started after the building was on fire. Court records claim that Shepard was, quote, seen walking back to the building next door, started to take off the sheet and bathrobe, then entered the building next door wearing a shirt and pants. And again, police have now arrested Kenneth Leon Shepard for this arson. No word on if he'll face any charges like attempted murder. But once again, a guy known to the system. And looks like he's been allowed to be in that revolving door of justice since right about the time the very first Star Wars movie came out. All right, our hero of the day. Actually, before we move on to our hero of the day, Fox 5 in D.C. Reporting more on the criminal history of James Brown III. Man with, a lengthy criminal history. Channel 5 says that according to court records, the 34-year-old was charged with attempted murder in 2001 before pleading guilty to lesser charges, sentenced to 4 years in prison with credit for time served for attempted murder in 2001. 2006, charged with unlawfully possessing a weapon and body armor as a felon, as well as drug charges. He pleaded guilty to cocaine possession, and the other charges were dropped. The gun charge was dropped. Felon in possession was dropped as a charge, and he got 5.5 years in prison for the cocaine charge. Now again, in federal court, possession of that firearm would have gotten him 10 years. Brown's record shows as well that he pleaded guilty to domestic battery and aggravated battery of a pregnant woman in 2012 and was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. That was probably plea bargained down as well. So again, all of these charges, time after time, the plea bargain is given, the charges are reduced, and even the sentence that is handed down on paper or the sentence that is handed down by the judge is not what James Brown III actually did. And again, that is not unusual either. That is the norm. All right, let's get to our hero of the day from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Story of a deli worker able to defend himself after armed robbers entered the building. It was Suleiman's Market on the west side of Cleveland. Wednesday night, the deli owner, 54-year-old man from North Olmsted, who wants to remain anonymous, understandably, told the plain dealer that if he wasn't armed, the robbers likely would have killed him and his friend. He said, "I was so panicked and scared, they would have killed both of us. What's going to stop them?" It's about 9:45 in the evening. Owner's there, manning the counter, talking to a friend who was helping him run the shop. All of a sudden, two masked men burst into the building, pointing guns and demanding money. Now, outside of the store, a guy walking by sees the two masked men enter the store with guns. He flags down a passing police car. Inside the store, the owner's cooperating with the armed robbers. He empties the cash register of about $300. Robbers grab the cash, and then they run towards the front of the store. And they stop when they see an officer standing outside. So then the armed robbers turn around, and they run towards the back of the store. The man's friend, the owner's friend, grabbed a gun from behind the counter and ran after the robbers. As one of the robbers entered the back room, Cleveland Plain Dealer reports, the friend grabbed him, slammed him into the wall. The second robber then ran and hid in a bathroom. The friend told police that he tried to coax the robber out of the bathroom, saying, "My gun is bigger than yours." The robbers surrendered and begged the man not to shoot him, according to reports. The friend ordered them to the ground, handed the owner his gun, while he searched the robbers for weapons. He found a gun and a magazine in their pockets. The friend then called 911. Keep in mind, they didn't know that the officer was outside at this point. So the friend calls 911, tells the dispatcher, "I'm holding two armed robbers at gunpoint inside the store here." He eventually went outside to talk to the officers because the dispatcher said, "I think we have somebody on scene." So he goes outside. The owner stays inside with his gun trained on the robbers. Police at this point had brought out the SWAT team to handle the armed suspects. The owner of the plain dealer reports ordered the robbers to crawl outside, where they were immediately arrested. The suspects expected to face charges of aggravated robbery. Now, again, those are the charges. They will probably be pleaded down to petty larceny. 19-year-old man from Parma, Ohio. 18-year-old man from Cleveland. The suspects who were arrested, no names of those suspects, and no word on what kind of criminal history they might have. But the owner of Suleiman's Market and his friend helping to run the store there Wednesday night, able to defend themselves with the help of a firearm. They are our heroes of the day today. And our good guy of the day, from Lakewood, New Jersey, and the Lakewood Scoop. I don't think we've ever used this publication as for our good guy before. But they had a great story. Stephen Meyer is a Lakewood, New Jersey police officer. He's been an officer there for 2 years. He was off duty. He was having lunch at a restaurant in Howell when he saw the manager and another employee of the restaurant run over to a man who was choking on his food. And they had no luck in performing the Heimlich. So Stephen Meyer, off duty, out of uniform, identified himself as a police officer, asked if he could try. He performed the Heimlich and managed, after a second thrust, to dislodge the item that the 80-year-old man was choking on. The Lakewood Scoop says the man was then sat down and given a drink. Emergency personnel arrived moments later, but the man refused further medical attention. Now, the paper talked with Officer Stephen Meyer, who said, quote, "It felt great to be able to help someone, and that I was in the right place at the right time." Again, two of the three conditions he acknowledges, because it probably sounds bad to say, "And I did the right thing," but that's a big part of it. It wasn't just that Stephen Meyer was in the right place at the right time. It was that he was willing and able to do the right thing. It wasn't just that he said, "I want to help." He actually knew how to help. Officer Meyer's father is also a member of the Lakewood Police Department, Captain Gregory Meyer. 30 years on the force. He told the Lakewood Scoop, the officer in Howell phoned me at the department to make us aware of this heroic act. He said, it certainly is nice, not only as his father, but that one of our officers sprung into action while off duty and made a difference. The Lakewood Scoop also says that Steve Meyer's uncle, Officer Rob Meyer of the Lakewood Police Department, also saved a man who was choking. This time it was a Michigan man. It was 23 years ago. But apparently these types of good deeds runs in the family, just like service there in law enforcement. So Stephen Meyer of the Lakewood, New Jersey Police Department, in the right place at the right time, absolutely. But again, willing and able to step up and do the right thing. And we thank the officer for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we come back to the program, John Cardillo is going to join us, host of the John Cardillo Show, a former New York police officer. We're going to talk again about the murder of Virginia State Trooper Chad Durmeyer by a man with a lengthy criminal history in Illinois. This, while violent crime is skyrocketing in the city of Chicago, and it looks like the powers that be really have no idea, no clue how to get a handle on the violence there. We'll talk about it with John after a quick timeout. Since they have no clue, no idea to get a handle on it, you can imagine they're talking a lot about the need for more gun control laws against law-abiding gun owners. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Shade McMillan with H&M Black Nitride, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is H&M Black Nitride? What's it all about?
We are, as opposed to all the different finishes that are out here in coatings, we are a heat treat business. And we service all the major OEMs and single gun customers at the SHOT Show.
How does it work?
It basically is a heat treat process that turns the parts black, adds corrosion protection, and it's a very slick and hard surface.
So it's I imagine that something, besides having a look to it, it's also great protective.
Yes. Very hard, very durable. The corrosion is extremely, there's nothing that can beat it.
Nothing that can beat it. And you guys are working with a lot of guys who would probably can attest to that. You got Bruce Pyatt, Tony Holmes, Doug Koenig, all signed on as sponsors.
Yes.
So why are they using it? Tell me why a shooter would want to use this.
When you have your gun and you're all on the range and in the elements and you're competing, then you can't always take care of your weapon. It's a tool. Okay? It's not all meant to be pretty. What we do is provide that corrosion protection, that wear protection, that makes sure that they feel confident that their gear is always going to work.
It's H&M Black Nitride. I imagine, Shay, this has got, like, implications not only with shooting, with the military, with
yes.
law enforcement.
Yeah,
I
we
mean,
do a lot of aerospace work, locomotive. We have stuff in outer space for NASA we do.
Wow, that's cool. And you guys are also working over with your shooters here, but also with NRA over at Bianchi Cup as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, Bianchi Cup. My brother and I have been competing out there for 3 years. This will be our fourth year.
Cool.
We were the barbecue sponsor last
year
for
now,
the
now
Bianchi
talking.
Cup. And it's a great competition, very family-like. And we're a family-owned business, so we like that.
Awesome. How are we getting more information about H&M Black Nitride?
www.blacknitride.com.
Shay, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA
hey.
News.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is. is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA-certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Pohl. Thank you so much, sir. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Tony Katz coming up, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News right now, the host of the John Cardillo Show. Mr. John Cardillo, former New York police officer, joining us on the program. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mr. Cam Edwards. How are you?
I am, I'm okay. We've been talking a lot about the death of Virginia State Trooper Chad Dermeyer on the program today,
yep,
as well as the man believed to be his murderer, James Brown III. Guy with a very lengthy criminal history, John, and, you know, look, I know it's like a broken record for people who listen to you,
yep,
and I talk about this, but that's because, you know what, it never changes. Here we have another guy, 34 years of age, lengthy criminal history, and a history of those serious charges, like attempted murder, being plea bargained down to next to nothing. And once they're plea bargained down, he still doesn't even do the time that he is sentenced to, right? I mean,
no,
when we talk about the revolving door of justice, this is what we're talking about.
I lost my voice on my show about this. I was so upset about this today, and I think you saw my tweets, but I'm now going to devote a segment every week to exposing these judges. A friend of mine, an NYPD detective who ran a homicide task force, he's retired now, one of the best investigators I know, has already uncovered 82 separate charges on this guy, this murderer, James Brown III, in one county alone. Why was this guy, 82 charges, most of them violent, Cam, why was this guy walking around? There is no excuse for it. I defy any of these judges to tell me why this guy was walking around free.
And, you know, we listened earlier to I think it was the superintendent of the Virginia State Police who was holding a press conference. And he was asked about this, you know, why did this guy have a gun? And he said, yeah, it's troubling that this guy had a gun. It's also troubling that this guy was out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, getting the gun's the easy part. That question isn't why did this guy have a gun. He was a career criminal who hung around with violent criminals. That's the easy answer. Why was he on the street? That's really the only question. Had the judges done their jobs, and I'm not letting the prosecutors go on this one either. The prosecutors agreed to these plea bargains. Shame on them. They're just as culpable as the judges. Had both of them done their jobs, why did he have a gun would be an irrelevant moot question because he'd be sitting in a cell.
You know, we've got some audio here from the governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe. He was on DC radio today, DC 101, Elliott in the Morning. And he brought up guns, John. He wasn't asked about this by the host of the show. He brought this up. I want you to listen. It's about 2 minutes long. Just listen,
sure,
to Governor Terry McAuliffe, and then we'll talk about what he had to say.
As I say, there are too many guns out in society today. There are too many guns, Elliot, in the hands of the wrong people. You know, what we're trying to do is just common sense. This individual who had a criminal record, had mental issues, should not be able to possess a handgun.
And, you know, and it's we were talking about it this morning because, I mean, and listen, you have to deal with it at a much different level than we do. I just try to come in and do a stupid radio show every day. But it was, you know, Monday was the shooting at the Capitol. We end the week with the shooting in Richmond. Throw on top of that just up north in Baltimore, where cops just happened on two guys with assault weapons. And I was going to ask you, and listen, I don't know what the answer is, and I'm sure that you guys work on that every single day to try to figure it out. But it's going on way too much. It's way too often.
That's right. And listen, today is a day, obviously, sympathy for the surviving spouse and the two children. So obviously today we're thinking about the family and then all the families impacted, as you know. But there is a broader issue, and how do we deal with these folks who today possess firearms that should not have them? Mark Kelly and Gabby Giffords, I just had dinner with them down here in Richmond 3 days ago. You know, we're all just trying to get to a place for common sense restrictions. Mental illness, those, obviously, the huge problem we have in Virginia in 2014, you know, we had 122 people killed on domestic violence, and 66 of those, Elliot, involved a firearm. Now, luckily, we were able to work in a bipartisan way for a new law here in Virginia. If you're under a permanent protective order, you have to hand your gun in within 24 hours, and if you don't, you lose it for life.
Right.
But, you know, we all need to just, this is common sense, just common sense restrictions.
Common sense restrictions, John, against people like you and me, and frankly, you know, people like Trooper Dermeyer's family. But there already are common sense restrictions on people like James Brown III possessing a firearm because he's a convicted felon.
I think, you know, I try to keep my cool as a radio host when I hear things like that, but the cop in me wants to put my fist through a sheetrock wall. That is shameful of Terry McAuliffe, A, to politicize the murder of one of his troopers, not even a full calendar day after the trooper is killed. Shame on him. And to blame it on gun control, to not call out the liberal politicians on his side of the aisle who appointed or helped elect the liberal judges that freed guys like this. I have to say, that was an absolute disgrace. Terry McAuliffe should be ashamed of himself, and he deserves nothing but public ridicule and scorn for politicizing the death of that trooper as soon as he did. There's no two ways about it.
You know, and what's sad, John, I don't think that he'll apologize.
No.
I don't think that we'll see any of that. And as a matter of fact, you know, I think we'll see a lot more of this type of politicizing of the death of a Trooper Chad Dermeyer in Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, we see it right now in Chicago. You know, violence is skyrocketing right now. It's about twice the homicides that we saw this time last year. Shootings are through the roof. It really seems like the city has very little idea of what to do to try to get a handle on this crime. And what are we hearing, John? We're hearing a lot of talk about we need to do something. And that something should take the form of gun control laws aimed at the law abiding. You know, I understand that you don't want to get upset. You don't want to be frustrated by this. But, you know, look, as a police officer, you know this very well. The people who are the good people in these bad neighborhoods who have been living with this violence in some cases for decades. How many times, John, have they been told, you know what we need is another gun control law? If you just get behind us on this next gun control law, then your life is going to improve. The lives of your kids are going to be safer. How many times have they been lied to that the next round of gun control laws is going to be the one that works?
Well, it's such gross irresponsibility. It's such a negligence and abandonment of the duty of the politicians at this point, especially in Chicago. Now, we can really look at Chicago because it is the perfect example of everything wrong with progressive governance, Cam. Let's talk about the crime problem. A quick analogy. Chicago is like a boat that someone took a chainsaw to the hull and just ripped a gaping hole in, and they're trying to put paper and some paint over it to patch it. Chicago has decades-long systemic organized gang crime, gangs like the Gangster Disciples, the P-Stones, going back to the 60s, the Bloods and the Crips partner with them. Systemic organized crime, that's what's causing the murders in Chicago. It's not gun control. It's not this. It's not that. The government in Chicago is so progressive they won't acknowledge it. They won't acknowledge it because it's predominantly African-American crime. They refuse to bring in police administrators that will actually confront the real problem and do something about it. So they fire Gary McCarthy after the death. You know, the guy was shot 16 times. Mm-hmm. They fire Gary McCarthy over that. They haven't been able to bring a new permanent chief in until recently because of the testing deficiencies in the candidates. So they bring in this guy Johnson, who's their chief of patrol, but he's relatively new to chief law enforcement officer status. He's a relatively new policing administrator. So privately, the cops I talk to around the country, retired commissioners, chiefs, are saying this is going to be a disaster. He was the politically correct pick because he most mirrors Rahm Emanuel's politics, and it's going to be murder as usual in Chicago. Nothing will change.
You know, listen, I can't disagree with you, unfortunately. And this is, you know, this is why it's so disheartening to talk about the crime problem in not just Baltimore, but in Chicago, because you really don't see much change on the horizon, unfortunately. You know, when you've got people who say that, you know, it's all because of the gun laws in Chicago. Well, our gun laws haven't changed, John, in this country over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. We haven't seen, steps taken to make it easier for convicted criminals to walk into a gun store and buy a gun. We, as you say, you know, criminals have never had a problem acquiring what they want on the black market, right?
Oh, no.
Might be a matter of how much they're paying for it. But I saw a story earlier this week that handguns in Chicago are being sold on the black market for as little as $25.
Yeah, that's the popular misconception. We used to see that in the Bronx as well. You know, they like to tell you, no, it's only the real sophisticated organized criminals that get guns on the street because Glocks are selling for $1,000. Well, A, that's not true. And B, these guys aren't buying Glocks. These guys are buying, you know, 30-year-old piece of junk Raven 25s. But you know something? They get the job done. They can kill and they get the job done. These guys don't care about the quality of the hardware. They'll take whatever they can get. And believe me, the stolen guns, the illegal guns, the guns that come up from south of the border, they're abundant. We did analyses on this several times. There are about 100 million illegal guns out there. If we eradicated every legal gun and every illegal gun, 99% of them, that would still leave 1 million guns out on the street, only in the hands of criminals. We've got about 12,000 murders a year in the U.S. by gun. So each criminal would have about 80 guns to choose from. I mean, math is not biased. Math shows you what a fallacy gun control is.
Absolutely, it does. You know, and this is, I think, the heart of what it is that we're talking about here. Terry McAuliffe says, we've got to do something about the guns. Well, you know, look, we may have 400 million firearms in this country. And the vast majority of them, the vast majority of them, are owned by legal, yeah, law-abiding gun owners. We don't have 400 million cold-blooded killers in this country.
Oh, absolutely not. Right.
It is much easier and it's much more effective, not to mention constitutional, to focus on those individuals who are perpetrating this violent crime. I think it was The Guardian, Lois Beckett, who I know that you've had some exchanges with on Twitter, had a piece.
Yeah.
She was in Chicago. I don't agree with all of Lois Beckett's conclusions, but I thought her reporting was pretty solid. And she pointed out, these researchers have you know, figured out that if you are among about 6% of the population in Chicago, where you've got a lot of criminal associates or family members or friends, you are much more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. You're much more likely to be the perpetrator of a violent crime than, you know, the other 94% of Chicago.
That's right. Yeah.
And you can burrow down even further, because within that 6%, you're really talking about a much smaller number of individuals who are responsible for that violent crime. We know who they are. I think it's fair to say that James Brown III may have been one of those individuals.
Well, we know he was, right? His criminal, his history proves that.
Yeah. So why can't we, John, focus on those individuals who are known to law enforcement, who are already in the criminal justice system? Why can't that be the primary focus of law enforcement there in Chicago? If we want to stem the violence, we've got to start with the people who are committing more than their fair share.
You know, I don't want to sound like a partisan, but it's progressive politics, progressive mindset, Cam. It's the same reason that when we know we have a radical imam in a mosque in Brooklyn – who has fundraised for terrorists and recruited for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, we can no longer stick confidential informants on his mosque. Progressives want to tie our hands and only want to focus on their pet political agendas. In this case, it's gun control. In the case of terrorism, it's white Christian men legally armed are just as dangerous as radical Muslims. And so we are now living in a world where the politically correct narrative trumps saving children's lives. And I hate to sound like liberals. What about the children? But it's true. The people that are dying here are young black men, 18 to 24. They're the ones dying at the highest rates at the hands of other young black men, 18 to 24, because of and they're being shot at the highest rates. I give them the stat all the time. Young black men, 18 to 24, are 0.5% of the U.S. population, Cam, but they commit 11% of all murders. And 90% of the murders they commit are against other young black men, 18 to 24. But we're not allowed to talk about this epidemic. We're not allowed to talk about it, because if we do, we're racist and we're oppressive and we're invoking our white privilege and we're trying to oppress people of color. It is so ridiculous. And I think that's about the most racist thing you can do, is to not talk about a problem and try to solve it.
Yeah, and I think that attempts to try to shut down what it is that we're talking about here, you know, with accusations of racism, you're right. I mean, that doesn't, again, it is the opposite of helpful. And all I can think about, you know, John, I mean, we've talked about this on the program before. I met my wife. She was a single mom living in Camden, New Jersey. At the time, Camden was the murder capital of the United States. She had, when I met her, her son was five. Her daughter was 11. They're my kids now. Thankfully, they've grown up. They're healthy. They're happy. But I, every day, John, I think about what their life would have been like had we not met, had I not convinced her to move from Camden, New Jersey to Oklahoma, a place she knew nothing about. But a place, by the way, that she was okay with going to, because it meant getting out of Camden, New Jersey, the murder capital of the United States. There is not a day that goes by that I don't think about how my kids' lives would have been different had they stayed in Camden. You know, this isn't some theoretical discussion for me. I am well aware of the violent crime that goes on in too many of these neighborhoods. I am well aware of the toll that is perpetrated against, you know, good men and women and good kids in these neighborhoods. And I'm also well aware of the fact that there are restrictive gun control laws in place in many of the most violent cities in America, and they don't do anything to stop those criminals. They stop people like my wife from being able to legally own a gun. You know, for decades in Chicago, it was impossible. It was literally legally impossible for you to legally own a handgun in the city of Chicago. And yet the criminals didn't care. They just didn't care what that law was. They were more than willing to violate laws far worse than that.
Well, that's I've always said that. I mean, murder is illegal. So for Terry McAuliffe to talk about the gun as if a gun law is going to do something, I mean, I'm sorry, Terry McAuliffe, Governor, you sound like a moron. Murder is illegal, and the guy still committed murder. Do you think he's going to care about the lesser gun offense? That's the one that really infuriates me. They're masters of ignoring the obvious, and they will. And what's even worse, Cam, is they insult everyone else's intelligence by selling us what they know to be not just a false narrative, but policies that will do nothing to reduce crime and will only further a leftist political agenda that, by the way, if you talk to any progressive, they have no idea why they're anti-gun. They don't even know why they're anti-gun. It's just historically been what progressives are, so they drink the Kool-Aid and they follow the pack.
Well, it's time we listen. I think no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, think for yourself. You know, Barack Obama said, "Well, there's no big difference between capitalism and communism. Just go with what works." Listen, that's a stupid bit of advice. But think about what works. Let's start there. No matter where you fall on the political spectrum, think about what works. Think about what hasn't. Because honestly, I mean, as you say, John, the people in these neighborhoods, the people in these communities, they deserve so much better than what they're getting from their elected officials.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I know we run out of running out of time, but I always tell the story of a kid we arrested with a gun, but we knew he wasn't a bad kid, but he was in a car with three really bad kids. And we knew he was following because he was afraid. We helped him. We got him out of the neighborhood. We got him a job at a pool as a lifeguard in a better part of the city, a city job. This kid never got in trouble again. We helped his family move him to another part of the city. The kid never got in trouble again. Graduated high school, went to college. So you're right. I know it's anecdotal, but I know in my heart you're 100% right. If you can make the bad neighborhoods a little bit safer, or you can get families out of them, things do change for the better.
Absolutely. And listen, you're right. We are running out of time. We know that there's certainly a lot more than just a law enforcement perspective that has to go into that.
Right.
You know, that's the problem.
Societal, political, yep.
Absolutely. So, listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program. We need at some point, here's the problem. When is your show on, John? Is it noon to 2?
Noon to 2, and then a morning show in Miami, 9 to 10. So I got to have you back next week.
Holy cow, man.
There's a lot to talk about. I know.
That's amazing.
I know.
All right, well, at some point, we got to get you up here because I'd love to just sit down with you for 3 hours here in studio and talk about this stuff.
I have some business in D.C. coming up over the next couple of months. We'll coordinate it offline.
Fantastic. All right, John. Thank you again, sir, and we'll talk to you soon.
You've got it, my friend. Take care.
John Cardillo joined us, host of the John Cardillo Show, which you can hear now, noon to 2, and in Miami there, 9 to 10 for John Cardillo. When we come back after a quick timeout, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. You can hear him, I think it's 6 to 10 on WIBC. And Tony will join us after a quick break. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Teresa Vail is with us. How are you, Teresa?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Love the shirt, by the way.
Thank you. I feel like I'm all NRA'd out with the coat and the shirt.
Right.
Got to represent.
Are you having a good time here at the Great American
Absolutely.
Outdoor Show?
This is actually my first year here. I'm used to SHOT Show and the NRA convention. This is a new ball game. There are tons of people here. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, and this is huge, too.
Yeah,
it's massive.
The complex is amazing.
And it's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned SHOT Show and the NRA annual meeting, and these are both, you know, events that you'll get anywhere from 50 to 80,000 mm-hmm. attendees. Mm-hmm. We're looking at somewhere around 200,000
people. That's what they said.
Here.
I know. Walking through the halls of this place is nuts. It is chaos.
And for 9 days, you know, we get these crowds, which really shows you, I think, just how popular the outdoor sports and the world of the outdoors really, truly is in this country.
I was going to touch on that. That's what I love about these conventions, about these trade shows. This one especially, because it brings together like-minded individuals. Everybody here, you know that they're supporters of the NRA, probably, or they love hunting, they love the outdoors. It's like-minded. You're with people who think and feel that the way you do.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit. For those who haven't had a chance to really get to know you, what's your background? How did you get into the world of hunting and shooting?
My dad started me hunting when I was 10. Bow hunting is what I really prefer to do. I didn't get into that until about 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago.
And all of a sudden you just, that you love it.
I'm drawn to it because of the intimacy. Instead of being 150 yards or 200 yards away from an animal, you need to be, 30, 40 yards, perhaps even closer. So I like that up and close personal feel to it. And I think it gives you that much more respect for the animal. But there's still a time and place for guns. I prefer guns for protection, for personal defense. I carry. I love going to the range.
You don't want to use a compound bow for personal defense? That's not your preferred choice?
I don't think I'd be as quick on it. Have you seen the TV show Arrow?
I have.
Okay, so that's what comes to mind.
And, right.
You know, he's a badass with a bow, but
we can't all be superheroes.
But we can't all be superheroes as much as I would like to be, and I try to be.
Right. Yeah. And so tell me, because you've had the opportunity to go and do some incredible hunts and visit some incredible places, the people that you talk to and that you're involved with in these hunts, is that as important to you as the game that you're actually going after?
I think hunting, there are two aspects to it. It can be very, very personal, and then it can be very, very social. The dichotomy, I think, is what makes it so fascinating. I like the social aspect because we can go out pheasant hunting, and while you're pheasant hunting, you get to joke around and talk, and you don't have to be hush-hush. It's very social and lively. But then that other side of it is you can be in the tree stand alone by yourself for hours and just have that solitude and peacefulness. And that's what I prefer. I'm a lone wolf. It's what I prefer. But the dichotomy of it is fascinating, and I do love both aspects.
You know, and in this modern connected world, too, I think it's so important to have those moments where you are disconnected. And it's you and the tree stand and nature, and you know, there's that focus, but there's also that ability to just sort of let all of that other stuff go.
I couldn't agree more, and that's my peaceful place. So everybody knows the Serenity tattoo that I have, and I got that because of my feelings for the woods. The woods gave that peacefulness to me. You know, when Dad started taking me out when I was 10. There are no cell phones. You can bring a book, sure, but you're still disconnected from the internet, from the age of social media, which I hate. There's a time and place for it, but I do hate it.
Yeah.
And you're away from that, and you get to focus on what's really important.
Absolutely. So tell me about what you have going on now with all of your, again, it is an interconnected world, and we get a chance to watch you on TV.
Yes.
We get a chance to watch you on NRANews.com.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up with everything you're doing.
We just wrapped up filming season 5 of NRA All Access. I hosted season 5. We're now moving on to season 6 of NRA All Access, and that's on Outdoor Channel Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
And we're just coming up with new ideas for season 6, moving into season 6. Season 5 was incredible. We went to Italy and hunted pheasants there and toured the Franchi shotgun factory and saw the intense history behind it. So I'm looking forward to season 6 and what it brings.
Thank you so much for tuning in to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Want to welcome to the program right now, not Eddie Money, sort of the Eddie Money of Indianapolis radio, though, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News. How you doing, Tony?
There's some Eddie Money of Indianapolis radio?
And it's you. How do you feel about that?
What would that look like?
Like Tony Katz. That's what it would look like.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
I'm just saying your money. That's all. Just saying your money.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am in Atlanta, Georgia right now.
What?
I'd like to get around. I like to see the world. Took the drive through Kentucky and Tennessee and just literally arrived just moments ago. And everyone here says hello.
Nice. Well, they'll say hi to everyone back for me. So you drove to Atlanta from Indy.
Yeah, why not?
Now, listen, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm actually planning on driving from Farmville to Louisville for the NRA annual meeting. Same reason.
Excellent.
I mean, you just drive through beautiful parts of the country when you do that.
Now, how much of the Bourbon Trail will you do?
I'm hoping to do a little bit. I'm putting together my map right now. I'm hoping to hit up a couple of distilleries while I'm there.
Okay. All right. Listen, you need some help. I'm in.
All right, we can plan this. It'll be a little road trip. You know, Bullet is actually based, I think, in Louisville, so hopefully I can at least swing by there at some point.
Yeah, I mean there are so many and so many small ones as well. I don't know who's where, but I'm sure that after the third stop on the trail, you won't remember or care.
Exactly. Will you be driving for me?
Listen, I don't wear the cap, but I hadn't even thought about that.
But
the wheel for certain parts, certain segments of the trip.
Now I'm going to have to look for a cap before I see you in Louisville. So I got to ask because I don't know, and I apologize, I don't know quite how long you've been on the road, but were you in town earlier this week when the story broke about the mom in Indianapolis who is home with her baby when a guy breaks in with zip ties and a walkie-talkie, and she's able to defend herself.
No, that's a story that was much more recovered by our news side there at WIBC. But it's not the first time we've had stories like this. It's not the first time we've seen these kinds of things happen and people being able to defend themselves. And you're always left at that moment asking the Shannon Watts faction of America, what would you have rather? Would you have rather they not defend themselves? Would you rather people just be held hostage, if you will? Would you rather they died? Very often you get the feeling that they'd much rather have the statistic than the story, right? They'd rather have a statistic that they can point to prove their cause than have the story of the person who was able to protect and defend themselves. I question that kind of attitude and view of the world, but that's one of the reasons I fight it.
I'm curious, did you see any of the local media, did you see Shannon Watts actually commenting on this story on any of the local?
No, I'll tell you that story actually had a fair amount of radio silence, to use a phrase, and television silence as well. You didn't hear people cheer anybody on, and you didn't hear anybody going into detailed explanations of why, oh, this is really rare, really you're better off without a firearm. There was none of that. Now, it could just be that, you know, Indiana's looking at some other issues, and there have been some really horrible stories. The death of Deputy Carl Kuntz, who was shot and killed serving a warrant. Well, criminals are out there and bad things happen. It was a horrific story. And then there was another story that is too horrible to talk about. I won't talk about it. Those were really dominating Indiana and Indianapolis airway over the past week. So this story did not get much play at all in Indianapolis.
Interesting. Even there locally. Again, talking with Tony Katz of WIBC in Indianapolis. So I've got to ask you, Tony, since you're in Atlanta, are you going to be stopping by Emory University with any chalk?
That's a great question. I was going to do it in lamb's blood in preparation for Passover. I can't just have these kids just falling over and dying everywhere, you know. But aren't they precious, these special little flowers?
Yeah, they are.
I thought it was sticks and stones break your bones, but names will never hurt you. Turns out, no, the names are worse than sticks. So in my way of thinking, let's try the sticks.
You know, I brought this up the other day. I guess we're not teaching kids that saying anymore because, and it really has been over the past year that I've heard on college campuses, and really only on college campuses, this idea that words are violence, Tony, and that if something is said that makes somebody else feel bad, that is, in essence, an assault. That's battery. That's verbal battery.
If words are violence, exactly how do they react to the Declaration of Independence? How do these special flowers, and by the way, screw the special flowers, how do these special flowers react to the idea that a bunch of ragamuffins who thought they were something told the King of England to stick it? I'm curious to see if they were to read these grievances that the colonists had, if they would then say this was somehow obscene. You know, would they view that as words that were more offensive than the idea of not paying the taxes, which one was more offensive to the special flowers?
Well, okay, keep in mind, you're talking
they're not decent people.
Now, listen, you're talking about the precious snowflakes. So I think what they would find offensive is the fact that the Declaration of Independence was even written, that a slave owner like Thomas Jefferson would have penned the words of the unalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I object to this.
See, the difference is that Thomas Jefferson wasn't perfect, but he was on to something. Karl Marx wasn't perfect, and he was a moron. See, there's the fundamental difference. Karl Marx never created anything. Karl Marx never did anything for society. Karl Marx never built anything. Everything Karl Marx believed and everything that Karl Marx wrote, which is pseudo-intellectualism at best, has never produced anything ever. Hasn't produced a better society, hasn't produced a better person, hasn't produced a better iPhone, and hasn't produced a better movie. It hasn't produced a better meal. It hasn't produced anything. But Thomas Jefferson, that imperfect son of a bitch, produced a pretty damn good country if we just allow it to run. I say good on him.
All right, well, on that note then, before we run out of time, let me ask you, President Obama in Argentina, last week, and actually said...
You don't have enough time for me on this subject. Listen, Barack Obama's not a smart man. And never mind that he's not a decent man. And I used to say it was about the policies. No, it's about the man. If you stand ramrod in front of Che Guevara, you're not a decent man. That's the way it goes. He said, and the line you're using is, you could take something from communism, something from capitalism, find what works best. I defy him to show me something that works in communism ever in the history of the world. Show me anything that works in communism in the history of the world that you can pull from. Anyone, whether it's him, Valerie Jarrett, Eric Holder, any of the special snowflakes or special flowers or whatever we call these worthless, horrible, disgustingly schmucky people. Show me something that works from communism. I'm waiting. At Tony Katz on Twitter. I'm waiting.
Well, you know, the president said education in Cuba is a success story.
He'll point to literacy rates, right? In Cuba, they must have a great literacy rate. What good is a literacy rate when all you get to read is the propaganda that Raul Castro gives you? What good is an education when you're not allowed to think for yourself? What good are these things? Let us not be fooled. There is no education in Cuba. That is a lie. But then again, people who believe lies tell the lie, spread the lie, and bathe in the lie. These are the worst people in the world. They're schmucks. Don't let your kids grow up to be like them.
Yeah, look in here. Now, granted, this is Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt. But the primary school curriculum in Cuba includes dance and gardening, lessons on health and hygiene, and Cuban revolutionary history.
Wait a second. If they do health and hygiene, maybe I'm all wrong, because the Occupy movement could have used some of that.
All right, well, listen, when we have a chance to spend more than a couple minutes with you on this subject, I would love to hear more of your thoughts about this. I know you were talking about this on Twitter. I'm glad to know it set you off as well, because that statement, like I said, I thought I was done being shocked by things that the president could say at this point. And that one actually kind of took me, came out of left field, literally, and that one took me by surprise.
If you believe communism has value, you are inherently violent. Barack Obama is an inherently violent man.
Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Just ask, I guess, well, you could ask any number of people, I suppose. You know, the president, he's into those drone strikes still, right, Tony? President Peace Prize?
No, he's into droning on. And on. And on.
But man, can he dance.
No, he can't. That she leads. No, watch. Watch the tango.
I know.
He can't dance. You can't dance the tango and keep your jacket buttoned.
I'm just teasing.
Nobody taught him anything. Literally, being a man for him is impossible.
I was just teasing. I'm not even going to ask you about eating pizza. I'm not even going to bring that up.
With a knife and fork? Listen, there's a moment to eat pizza with a knife and fork. It just never happened on the campaign trail.
Tony Katz, enjoy Atlanta, buddy. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir.
Later.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Tony Katz of WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. I can't muster up even fake outrage for how people eat their pizzas. I just look at what's going on in the world today, and I'm like, you know, you could drink it. You could just blend it and drink it. I'd be like, well, that's a little odd, but, you know, whatever. Bigger fish to fry. I hope that you have a fantastic weekend. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Be safe. Have fun. We'll see you back here on Monday live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRANews.com, midnight Eastern, SiriusXM Patriot 125, on demand all the time at iHeartRadio and on iTunes as well. We'll see you soon.